There are different funding revenues for the state, one being a public protection fund that would perhaps best suit a need like this. That's my opinion on this, but thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Legislator Gavaris.
So it's related to this, but it also ties back into the conversation at the end of the meeting yesterday. You know, the way we're looking at funding and having the matrix, as Legislator Parity had talked about, you know, some of the questions that came to mind for me is, you know, we should be asking everybody is, do they serve the entire county? If we're going to come out of county funds, it should be a countywide benefit. And this, unfortunately, is not one of those. And to Legislator Haynes' point, you know, there are other fire companies. I know one of similar size as well, the Gronson Fire District. Very small district, very small tax base, but they've managed to do it through funding and grants or member items through the state legislature. So there is ways to get this kind of thing paid for that doesn't come out of the county funds. You know, some of the other questions you're asking related to the library, I would say, is if we were to give the money to them, is this benefit of the I don't know, video access and the different programs that are available through that, is it also available to out-of-county residents as well? And I believe the answer to that is actually yes, because the libraries go by school district, which cross county lines. So now we're paying for things in potentially Orange County and Sullivan County. I mean, you know, I really believe that what Legislator Parity said yesterday really needs to happen pretty quickly. We need a decision on a matrix or some kind of guidelines to say, is this something we really should be funding as a county, or is there another source that should be funding this?
Okay, Chairman Donaldson and then Legislator Cahill.
I understand where Legislator Gavaris is standing, but in regard to the libraries, you have to have a library card from one of the Ulster County Library Association libraries. So it really doesn't fund outside, I would assume, if you know, you belong to the library and that is out and you live outside the county, then you would be able to, yes. But it's basically zeroed in on mostly county. There may be some others, but these are software programs. So if somebody from outside is using it, it doesn't diminish anybody in the county in any way or form. I mean, I also, in regard to the fire districts, like, I agree with what Legislator Haynes said, is that we have like 46 different fire districts. The city of Kingston has paid firefighters, and they do have very small volunteers. They've been, you know, slowly dwindling away. So it becomes, I would, if we wanted to venture into these types of things, I would rather see set up some type of a program where we could maybe do, you know, some type of a building slowly, like that somebody could put in and, you know, go across all fire districts that would have an opportunity to do that. So they would be able to say, well, they need a little bit because they need to, you know, and they're going to enhance food for people working during COVID, shall we say, in that particular area. And there may be a number of fire districts in that way, maybe you can fund. But I mean, you might be able to figure out some type of formula, but just doing this for any fire district doesn't make a lot of sense to me because they have the ability, they have their own taxing district.
All right. Please note that Legislator Ronk joined the meeting, and Legislator Cahill, you had.
Thank you. Yeah, I did. I just wanted to remind us, as I recall, one of the we carried over last year's programs into this legislature from 2020. The budget carried into where this legislature actually voted for the 2020 budget allocations for this. And as I recall, there was a volunteer fire department that was funded for an item in that budget. And that's kind of why I threw that in there. I thought that since we did it last year for one fire department, it should be fair that we do it for others. Thank you.
Any other comments?
I have something, Lynn.
Okay, Legislator Ron.
Just as a point of information to Legislator Cahill about what that money was used for. That's to the Walker Valley Fire District, which operates a fire training center, which all of the, fire companies in the county were authorized or allowed to train at as part of that contract with Walker Valley. Prior to the fire training center being built in the town of Ulster, it was the, for a while, the only fire training center you could host a live burn at. So that's, to me, it's apples and oranges. I tend to agree with Dave. Each of these fire departments has its own taxing jurisdiction. Quite honestly, it's sort of some of the same reason why I continue to not support the county funding the People's Place, because each community has its own food pantry. And if we're going to fund one, we need to fund them all. I think that goes the same with the fire departments, because, I know that our fire department scrapes together money through fundraisers, including, selling Christmas trees right now to be able to, buy the equipment that they need, along with being able to tax. So I understand where you're coming from with this, and I respect it. I just can't support it for one fire department if we're not going to have, a competitive,
Thank you.
Okay, any other comments, questions? Okay, thank you, Legislator Cahill.
Yeah, I just want to let you know that I'll be back later. I have to go do some, take care of my work for a little
okay.
bit. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. Heidi, did you have something, or were you going to say the same thing I was going to say? Okay.
Okay. Next, we have Legislator Criswell, domestic violence. Can somebody make a motion to move?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second it.
Thank you. Legislator Criswell.
Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I wanted to ask if it makes sense to block these next two.
That's fine. Let's block them. Yep. If you want to talk about them together, that'd be great.
I'd like to. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the chair if it's possible to actually have Michael Berg, who's the CEO of Family Woodstock, speak to these programs briefly.
That's fine.
Michael?
Hello, Michael.
Hello, everybody. Nice to see you, if virtually. The situation is this. Families taking a number of cuts, not just in the area of domestic violence. We know the county is in tough financial shape this year, and we're a team player. So I wouldn't be here if it wasn't that this one area we've taken unusually severe hits. Basically, what's happened is the county is proposing to eliminate four contracts relating to the non-residential domestic violence program. It comes at a time when one state contract is also being cut. The net result of it is that $159,000 of county money and $40,000 of state money is being cut from a program that has a total budget of $159,000, or about 49% of the budget. This will really jeopardize what we're able to provide for non-residential services in the community at a time when domestic violence is surging. I know that Peter is proposing the restoration of two of the four contracts that will amount to reducing the cut in, from the county in about half. It would make a huge difference, and I could commit to the legislature that I would make that work. But I have to, and I work very hard, and the agency works very hard to bring money into the community. We have HUD money coming into this program. We have workers' justice money coming into the program. But the basic foundation of the program is in the Title 20 contract, which, for example, pays for the person we have at the family court. In 2019, that person handled 299 cases relating to orders of protection, custody issues. This is the basic protection that our county has, and right now it's in jeopardy. So I would gladly answer any questions, go over any finances that you want. This is really important to us.
Okay.
Thank you, Michael. If I may continue quickly.
Please, go ahead.
So just to finish my thoughts, so I believe that this is one of those situations where DSS said they can actually take over these services? And so I think that should be our conversation today. Is that a realistic action on their part? Do they actually have the staff that can do that to duplicate just the important work that Michael outlined? I don't know. And so I think that should be our conversation of is that possible?
I'm not sure we have someone here that can respond, but go ahead, Legislative Walter, and then Legislative Bartels.
Thank you. Michael, can you elaborate a little bit more? From my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, this is one of the sole sources of the services you're providing. Is that correct?
That is correct. And the way that services are provided in the county for domestic violence, they start with the hotline, which takes about 1,500 domestic violence calls a year. That's funneled to various, depending if it's a crime victims case, then it will go to crime victims. We mutually refer to crime victims all the time. Crime victims is limited to when the survivor is willing to take it up as a criminal action. As I'm sure many of you know, a lot of times the survivor doesn't want the police. They don't want the systems in their lives. They just want the violence to stop. And so it doesn't get to the point of a crime and therefore would not be eligible for crime victims. I'm surprised to hear that DSS is proposing that it can do it themselves. I'm not aware of any part of DSS that's currently doing domestic violence direct work. And I know that DSS has had a number of their staff retire, take early retirement. So I don't know where they would have the staffing to allocate specifically to this. I do know that the DSS did say that they would take over the liaison function, which was one of the four contracts. That's the only thing that I'm aware of they said they would take over. The liaison function was to provide advocacy at the DSS for people going there seeking public assistance. Quite often that process is a very difficult one and people need support. The other thing is that we put a person there that was Spanish speaking. And so that helped the DSS to deal with people that were very limited English speakers that needed help. That function, the DSS has said they've taken over. I don't know of any other function that they're intending to take over.
Okay, Legislator Bartels.
So on the issue of the DSS takeover, I'm wondering if before next week, maybe we can do some outreach to DSS, because I know we got conflicting information on the other contracts we heard about, which I think are coming up shortly, about whether or not DSS was actually going to take that over. Michael, can you explain the programs, the two that we've bundled together, what actually the services are? You know, once the calls get directed, can you talk a little bit about that?
The Title 20 money is directly paying for the court advocacy position. The other money, which is the family violence option, is money that we use to do the direct care, largely one-on-one. Right now, we're not able to do in-person groups, but we are still serving a lot of people one-on-one. And once we're able to, we will do groups again. So that's the primary service deliveries that we do are paid with those two contracts.
And if I can just ask a follow-on.
Right ahead.
Thank you. And in those two programs, how many people do you serve typically, and how would your ability in the Title 20, would it mean that there is no longer any service? Would the position have to be eliminated?
The full position is paid for by Title 20. If you're asking me, if I can fundraise money if you cut that off, I'm going to try. I mean, I think that it's essential that we have an advocate at the family court. Last year, in 2019, we served 200 – let me just make sure. I don't want to give you misinformation. Where is it? Uh, 299 people, of which 132 were resulted in stay awake orders of protection, and 112 resulted in no harassment orders of protection being issued. As far as the individual work that we did, we served 139 adults in groups, and we served 139 adults, some of who participated in groups, received one-on-one counseling and or case management. So those are the numbers for those two programs.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Commissioner Golnick.
Yeah, Lynn, I can definitely get more information from DSS. Again, this is what they did provide in terms of the budget. I will say on both of these resolutions, I just want to make the committee aware of the offset. It is the kind of minimum maintenance in electricity and gas at 101 Enterprise. That was what was budgeted for, and that's being reduced. I just wanted, the committee to be aware that is the offset to this increase in expenses.
And that's 201, not 101, right?
101. It is 101, Lynn.
Oh, it is 101.
Enterprise. Yeah. Okay. Hello, Michael.
Legislator Criswell?
Yes, I wanted to just follow up on that. I also wanted to highlight that's what we were talking about for the offset. But, I think when we're looking at domestic violence programs versus upgrade to sprinklers or something, you know what I mean? To me, it's apples and oranges. And so I think we just need to think about this as service to our county.
I'm not disagreeing or a thing. I'm just pointing it out to the committee, Peter. That's all. Yep.
And Bert, you will get back to us
Absolutely.
With some additional information before we have to decision this on Tuesday.
You'll probably get it tomorrow, Lynn.
Thank you.
Yep.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yeah, we have Michael on here. Hey, Chairwoman Archer, may I ask him the reference to yesterday's non-custodial visitations?
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you. Mike, I wanted to ask you in reference to the non-custodial visitation. I know it was brought up and I was under the understanding that it was somewhat mandated, but I guess it's not. Could you explain a little bit about the non-custodial visitation? And I mean, we have that in there right now as one of the amendments, but since you're here, I would like you to speak on that also.
Thank you, Dave. I don't understand why it's not considered mandate. Let's understand what we're really talking about. These are supervised visits authorized by the family court so that the non-custodial parent can have access to their children. It has to be supervised. Often it involves a domestic violence or similar kind of issue where they're not sure that the non-custodial parent will be appropriate with the child. And I don't see us as having, I don't see the county as having an alternative to the providing the service. There has been times in previous years where the money was not enough, and we actually fundraised a little bit to see that the service happens. Last year there was a cut. And this year the cut is okay for us because it was a downtime during which there weren't many visits held. But in general, the number of visits required, I think, would require us to have $30,000 rather than $20,000. But the other issue is that having to worry about it being cut because it's not seen as a mandated service is a concern to me.
Legislator Ronk?
Could I have a follow-up question on that?
That's fine.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, what would be our liabilities as a county if we did not provide the service? Or would we have liabilities?
I don't think the county has the right to not authorize the non-custodial parent to see their child. Beyond your responsibility or your legal responsibility, I think that it's very important that children not lose their non-custodial parent.
Right.
I mean, these are very important visits. we give the parents as much time. You know, if a person's traveling 3 hours to see their child, they haven't seen them in 2 months. This is really important. And so I really, you know, we're committed to this service because we see when that connection happens, how important it is. The other thing is there is an issue of safety, of separation. Unfortunately, often the parents are battling. There may have been domestic violence involved. We were doing them in what we considered a dangerous way by only having one staff person available. We did make a change to have another staff person available because we had a situation where the non-custodial parent refused to leave. There's a structure to it. The custodial parent brings the child, then leaves, then the non-custodial parent comes, does the visit, then the non-custodial parent is supposed to leave, and then the child is picked up. We're very concerned about the safety of the child and the parents involved.
Legislator Ronk.
Thank you. Just two things, Michael. Number one.
Hi, Ken.
How are you?
I'm good. Nice to see you.
You know, I think that Dave's mandated versus non-mandated was at its basest a legal question, because that was a question that came up yesterday, was whether we're mandated by the state to provide this service or not. And it's my understanding, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is only in cases where the parents, the custodial and non-custodial parents, cannot come to an agreement on the neutral third party to be there for the visitation.
I think that that's correct, and I think that the court has some concern in the issue. That's authorized.
Of course. Now, the other question that I have is, in cases of domestic violence, wouldn't the crime victims' assistance, be involved in, helping to, set these things up, either by court order or, by being an advocate in that area?
Generally, they go to the family court when it's not a criminal concern. And so crime victims wouldn't be involved if it's not a criminal concern, if there's not a criminal action.
But if there is a criminal action involved.
If there is a criminal action, crime victims might be authorized to do the visit, but I'm not aware of a situation where that happened. It may also be in a criminal action that a supervised visit would not be authorized.
Okay. I'm trying to understand the issue a little bit better. That's all. Thank you.
I would also advise the county that while I'm the son of a lawyer, I'm not a lawyer. And as far as the question of whether it's authorized and whether you must provide that service, I would recommend that you consult the county attorney or somebody that is more qualified to give you an answer on that.
Okay. Legislator Bartels.
Yes, and I just want to clarify for Michael's benefit as well, and sort of echo what Legislator Ronk said, that there are two separate questions. I think the question of whether or not it's mandated is a separate question as to whether or not it's a worthy program. And I don't think anyone's questioning whether or not it's a worthy program. It's just if it is in fact mandated for legislature to approve it every year, this program is hanging in the balance of the legislature year over year. So I do think we need to get to the bottom of this sooner than later. I mean, I felt like I had a handle on it, but, and I know Bert's going to be looking into it, but maybe we can get all the interested parties together and get the answers before next week. And if in fact it's mandated, it definitely should move to a different department than through legislative programs.
I would also encourage the county to do that research, and I would welcome having the opportunity to know what you find.
I will on my list for tomorrow. There you go.
Great. Thank you, Bert.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Legislator Guevara.
That's okay. A quick question. So,
sure.
Are all these cases court-ordered supervised visitation? Is it voluntary? Is it a mixture? How are these cases? And I guess that's sort of related to the mandatory question.
If we provide a supervised visitation that's not mandated by the family court, we would be doing it for free. All of the cases that we do under supervised visitation are mandated by the family court.
I'm just trying to understand this. How do you get then a case that is not court ordered to be supervised? How does that even come about?
Well, we provide services to a lot of domestic violence survivors that don't involve the family court.
Okay.
In fact, the bulk of them don't involve the family court. I mean, I just would share, and it's a grave concern to me, our hotline on average takes in 1,500 domestic violence calls a year. We're only doing 299 in orders of protection and stay awake at the family court. There's even less that go into the criminal cases. So there's a lot of violence and anguish and family destruction going on in a community that doesn't get to the level of a crime. And we help a lot of those cases. I wish we helped more.
Thank you for that explanation.
Any other questions?
I just think with that said, it just goes to say how important it is that we reinstate this funding.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all. Nice to see you.
And now we have...
Tracy had a question.
I'm sorry, who?
Tracy.
Oh, sorry, Tracy.
I did, but you know what? I'll wait. I mean, well, actually, since I'm being recognized, the one thing I was going to say is that, you know, again, it was my understanding, and just maybe now for Bert's... you know, edification so that he could follow up on it. It was my understanding that there are court cases where it's court ordered that the visits are supervised, but that the parents get the super, you know, through their own resolve, they get the supervision. They hire the supervision or they pay for it, or they agree to a term of who's going to do the supervising. And it was told to me that in some cases those are relatives, that the two parents said we're gonna go ahead, this is the person we agree, that these are the more difficult cases where they hire someone to do it.
Yeah.
Did you get that, Tracy? You, just so you know, you're breaking up a little bit, so I just want to make sure everybody understood what you were saying.
Okay.
Did you get that first?
I'm going to try to move to a better spot.
I'm going to try to look at all avenues, the legal avenue, and everything. And I think Chairman Donaldson also, you know, suggested that it wouldn't be in the legislature, but a department as well. So I got to find that niche too. So I will get back to this committee. No problem at all.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All righty. Anything else on these two? Okay, then let's move to family assistance. That's Legislator Criswell and Walter. Can I get a move on that? Somebody move?
I'll move for a second.
Okay, and Gavaris, thank you. Okay, so whoever is kicking this off.
I will. Thank you. So this is a variety of service providers who are assisting families again at this critical time that we have right now. It breaks my heart to think that we're going to be cutting programs that are helping families. I asked Brian Doyle to join us today, Chairman Archer, if I can ask your indulgence in having him speak a little bit to the family services program that's on this amendment.
Absolutely. Welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Archer, and every other legislator on this call. I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak to this issue, which we are considering to be quite grave, frankly. We have had a contract to provide services, both family visitation and also in-home or home-based services, for families who are at the brink of or at risk of deteriorating and dissolution. And the contract for 2020 had been $544,000, excuse me, for the year. And what is proposed here is a 50% cut. Now, we are fully aware, and we have had to endure a number of difficulties throughout COVID-19. We're aware of, we work with families who are subject to the hardships induced by COVID-19. We work with them every day. We also work with our funders and understand that funders are at a point of great difficulty too. But a 50% cut in this program, in my imagination, is beyond belief, beyond comprehension. We work with families who are, as I said, at risk of dissolution, where there has been neglect, where there has been abuse, and I'm speaking also from the standpoint of a former child protective services worker, where I saw these families who there were these grave problems, and yet it was very clear that out of home placement was not in the best interest of the children or the parents or the family at large, because that in and of itself can cause great trauma to a child, and of course cost taxpayers far more than they would be paying if they pay for these preventive services, which have been paid for up until now. So, you know, this proposed cut could bring with it the need for us to lay off our staff, half of our staff, and put them on the unemployment line. This is something obviously we don't want to do, nor do I think the legislators wish to do, nor for that matter does the county executive's office or the Department of Social Services wish to do. But again, I know there's difficult times that are being undertaken here, but it's extremely important to recognize that, you know, if these programs, if these services are not provided to these families, I am told that it's been said that the Department of Social Services would be able to pick up the slack. Well, in fact, the family visitation program that I spoke of is one which we were asked to take on because the Department of Social Services did not have the capacity to undertake that. And now that there have been, I think, 35 cuts in Department of Social Services staff, it's inconceivable to me that these services would be provided, at very least, at the caliber and the level that they need to be provided. The family visitation program is one where non-custodial parents have an opportunity to visit on a regular basis with their children. These are children who may be in foster care or in kinship care. The point of our program here is not only to provide the safe supervision for these visitations, which is extremely important, and I know Michael Berg spoke to that earlier, but also to help these parents through coaching, through modeling, through parent education, to achieve a level of responsibility and conduct and performance as a parent so that they might at one point be reunited with their children. The family program having to do with home-based services is for those families, as I said, where there has been neglect or abuse, and yet they are not near the point of having to see out-of-home placement, because there's a recognition that our work with these families, and we used, you know, proven curricula in working with these families and providing support, nurturing, teaching parents that being a parent is more than just about how to discipline a child. It's about a nurturing relationship that benefits that child and ultimately the family and the parent. In these instances, I'm thinking that in the course of a year, we've only had, I think, over 2,000 home visits, and yet only two instances where we had to report any difficulties to Child Protective Services. So I think that just speaks to the value and the power of the work that is being done by our terrific staff in our family education program. I am hoping that the legislature will consider restoring these cuts from the standpoint of what is humane for these families and in the best interest of the children, and also from the standpoint of preventing future expenses to the taxpayer that are brought about by out-of-home placement, institutional care, or foster care. Foster care in itself per child will cost over $21,000 a year. So I think the math says it as well. But, you know, at the bottom line is just in terms of the families, you know, most parents, they want to be good parents. I can't think of many parents who don't want to be good parents, but they may not have experienced the parenting that they needed in order to be that good parent today. And they, believe me, these parents, they crave guidance, they crave encouragement, knowledge, you know, and support, just how best they can be a good parent. So, and that helps to break the generations that we are all aware of that has to do with cycles of neglect and abuse. So I'm imploring the county legislature to please make this restoration one that we can, that allows us to carry our work forward into 2020. I'm also joined by our Chief Program Officer, Joan Crawford, who is a great supporter, not just supporter, but leader in the family education program, should you require further information or further detail.
Any other questions? Chairman Donaldson and then Legislator Walter.
Yeah, can you, when I'm looking at the amendment sheet.
We lost volume here, Chairman. We're not hearing you. We're still not hearing you, Chairman. Chairman, we do not hear you. You have no volume. There you go.
My phone was ringing, so I guess it would cut me off.
Okay.
So I had to hang up on him. I hope you don't get upset. it was actually, you know, Pat Ryan calling me. So, I'm trying to get a handle on the amendment here. I don't quite understand what's being added when I'm looking at that. Could that be cleared up, Amber?
I'm sorry. What was that?
I'm trying to understand the way the amendment is written here, what was actually taken that the county cut and what we're putting back in.
So for the family services contract, it was 50% cut. And so three out of four of these programs were 50%. The other one was 100%.
So the total amount to get back in is what?
200 and some thousand. Let me
272 for this program. 272. Is that an up to number, the 544 in the contract?
Yes, that is expense reimbursed. So if that contract is such that, you know, we don't provide all of the services or meet all of those expenses, then we would not be billing for all of that.
Can
I just speak to the amendment to answer
the question? Yep.
Okay. So the net change is the 941 if you just look at it without anything else, because it basically increases the adjusted item totals. Of bringing it up to 100%. Of that, federal aid covers 731,000 and state aid covers 28, which leaves a remaining 181,664. Just to sort of explain those parts, so it goes from the change down to how much we would need to provide from county funds.
So it'd be 181. It'd be 188,164, is that correct?
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And so just to clarify.
Well, that's basically what I wanted. I wasn't quite clear when I was looking at it, so thank you.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify a little bit more of where that revenue, what we saw that revenue coming from. After the review of the budget consultant's analysis of the budget, one of the things I had noted and asked was where the added revenue of from Airbnb, since we have the contract, it's been signed, and it's about, you know, I'm sure Bert can talk about how close it is, but it's sitting in insurance. So the question was, we, based on the comptroller's analysis, having that contract would give us up towards 300,000 additional revenues through short-term rentals. I'm imagining with COVID persisting, it would likely be even higher than that. And so when I had first reached out to Amber about the most logical way of reinserting a potential revenue, it was a little harder to just reinsert a potential revenue as an amendment on its own. But that we identified that we could put it here to offset these costs. I will add that if for 300,000 potential revenue, and again, I think that that's less than what it will be, that could cover not only this, but the two family programs, because the three together come to 287,575. And so if people are extremely uncomfortable with the reduction from the Tech City, I could say that this Airbnb short-term rental added revenue could cover all of this.
Great, thank you for that clarification.
And I'm sorry, while I have the floor, I just want to say one more quick thing.
Okay.
And about DSS covering this work, I'm extremely concerned about the how realistic that is for a couple of reasons. One is the fact that they have reduced their staffing, particularly caseworkers. The other that they haven't done it. And it's, you can't just, as someone who worked in this kind of world for several years, you can't just jump and start doing these programs, doing these services that family does and family services do. You can't, you haven't been doing it. You don't just move in and start doing it the next day. And so what I think will happen is that the referrals won't happen, that we'll see a 50% cut in referrals. So that means half the families that should have gotten services just won't. In each of these, I don't believe that it will be compensated for by DSS. I don't think that's what we're going to see any.
Okay, and lastly,
with COVID, all of these problems are worse than ever.
So volume is up. Okay, Chairman Donaldson, and then Legislator Ronk.
I don't. Now the added revenue is not in this amendment, though. Correct. All right. I don't see that in there.
No, it is.
I don't necessarily, what's that?
It is. Look under the last line, under Commissioner of Finance, the 181.
Okay. That's where you added the,
yeah.
All right, my concern is that I don't know about adding that on there. I don't know, I don't like to add something in there that you don't know if you're really going to get it at this point, because although we have a signed contract, I'm not sure if we're going to, and I don't know if I agree it's going to be more. I think it'll be less, but that's another issue. I'm not saying not to fund this. I'm just saying that I don't think that's going to come to fruition. I also do not think that DSS is going to cover this work. I don't see that happening. I don't see how they can cover it. And no different than the other thing we were talking about prior with Michael Berg and even the non-custodial thing. They're not going to cover those things. They haven't covered them. And like Legislator Walter pointed out, you just don't start doing that. It's not something that, I think I'll start doing custodial visitations tomorrow. It doesn't work that way. We all know that. So, I would like to see, if we can find the funding in a more secure place anyway, or at least more of it in a more secure place.
So Legislator Ronk, then Legislator Walter.
Thank you. Just through the chair to the Commissioner of Finance, I wasn't sure that Finance agreed with the $300,000 number that the county comptroller has been using as potential revenue, or any number in that area, for a voluntary collection agreement to bring in more than to bring in that much more than we're already bringing in. I just didn't know if you had any weigh in on that.
Well, my real concern, and we will probably pick up some revenue, I just don't know the amount, but the problem is with COVID, the last quarter of occupancy tax collections, we were down 23% from 2019. Will that continue? I don't know. I keep mentioning probably 80 to 85% of our revenue has been driven by your big hotels and the chains. So again, my concern is the 23% even from last quarter. It was even higher in terms of the percentage the prior quarter. I will have just one thing, Lynn, if it is still here. In terms of the federal aid, I have a question to DSS because this program could be capped. There are only a certain amount of it's called federal flexible funding, which is triple F. It is almost like a block grant. So that could be capped. I have a question when I saw this amendment this morning to DSS. I haven't received a response yet, but that is concerning if that is capped at $730,000 that we wouldn't have funding for. So again, as soon as I know, I will pass it on to this committee.
I have one more thing, if I could, Lynn, on the short term.
And then Legislator Walter.
Yeah, just on the short-term rental, issue, I think that one reason that we've actually, I don't think, seen an increase in Airbnb or other short-term rental, revenue from what we already get is, I know several people who have short-term rentals right now, have been during the pandemic renting their units out by a month or 2 months. At which point it ceases to be a short-term rental and qualify for occupancy tax, because at that point it's almost like an apartment rental and not a room rental, so they don't owe room rent rate on it.
Legislator, you want to respond, Bert?
Yeah, just quick to Legislator Ronk, it's a 90-day exemption, and I will say we have folks who do return those quarterly report returns saying they have that exemption. So there is the longer term renting from my assumption from New York City and things like that.
Legislative Walter.
Thank you. So I would say, first of all, and I don't know, Bert, if you could nod, the down 23%, are you talking about all of hotel motel occupancy or just the short term rental revenue?
That's for the whole quarter for the entire occupancy tax. We were down 23%.
Right. So I guess my answer, the three responses, I just want to make sure I cover them all. Mm-hmm. One is, yes, we know we're down by that the hotels and motels are down during a pandemic. And if you look at the projected revenue, it is lower already, assuming that we will be down while we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's my hope in 2021, we're expecting the vaccine to be fully public by late spring. So next summer, let's hope everybody just comes right back out. But the other part that it's down is because the contract hasn't been put into place. If during this past 6 months we had that Airbnb contract in place, we would have been well up over the 23%. I'm confident of that. I'm also confident of this projection. Not only did the comptroller do a pretty thorough job, but it's based on Airbnb reporting how much revenue was in Ulster County, and I know, and it's very public, how much that business has increased during the pandemic. And while there may be the 90-day exemption for many of these, it's less. And there's so much more revenue we could have gotten with Airbnb if we had this contract, but we will continue. And the last point is, just to Legislator Chair Donaldson's point, we project on sales tax. I mean, our whole budget is a guess here. I mean, we're hoping that we get it, and if we don't, but everything's a projection. And if anything, I trust this projection more than I trust our sales tax and property tax projection, because we know that people are out there doing the Airbnb. So I feel pretty comfortable, but there's no way we're going to budget anything on an actual number, because everything we do is on a projection. Thanks.
So I have Legislator Bartels and then Chair Donaldson.
Thanks. I apologize for this crazy image. I'm having sound problems downstairs, and
I can't see you with that
backlit
light
up here. I know. So I'll try to get it better. But I'm curious, since these contracts are billed for services, I just want to understand if if we didn't fully restore the funding at the start of the budget cycle, would you have to make those layoffs that you spoke about, or would you provide services at full capacity and then let us know when you were reaching the end of the ability to utilize the services based on the funds? I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm just trying to understand if there's a way to, if it all has to be restored right now for something we can evaluate partway into the year.
So I'd be happy to respond to that. First of all, if we were to continue our services, I'll say at full throttle, and then we were expensing against the contract as it is given to us at $272,000, and then came to a point where we exhausted those funds, and I don't even know if the county would permit this, but if we were to then come to the point where those funds were exhausted, then we'd have to cease all services altogether. And I don't see how that makes sense unless we have an assurance that we would be able to have the rest of the money restored. So the answer is that to be responsible, I think we would need to immediately, and we're coming up on the point at which we need to do those layoffs, we would need to immediately make those layoffs of two family educators, a case aide, and a program assistant at the outset of the year. If we know that we're going to be given two contracts and we are, you know, made fully apprised of that, then we could consider that. But I think the county needs to make the decision. And,
I understand.
You know, the county, Ulster County has been very clear in its commitment to these families in the past and over the years.
Yes, go ahead. And then Chairman Donaldson.
In the instance that you make those cuts at the start, if this funding was not restored, and you have the instance where you make those cuts from the start, would you just reduce capacity? There would be families you would say no to?
That is correct. You'd have to. Yeah. And you know, if then by some, if there were a restoration into the year, the staff that have been laid off, they've gone on to other jobs that they need to take. And so, you know, any new staff we were to take on would need to be trained and, provided the orientation and to get up and running. Joan, did you want to add anything to that?
Sure. And it's very comprehensive training that our staff go through. They actually go through the same training that a CPS worker or foster care staff worker would go through. And we've been brainstorming, the idea of front loading, right? You know, if we just build the county for the first 6 months, but as Brian said, then we'd hit a cliff come July 1, and have no money left and not be able to provide any service at all.
Okay, so we have Chairman Donaldson and then Legislator Walter. Thank you.
Now, I just want to respond about when you're adding revenue. Everybody understands this is the best educated guess you could come up with, but you have to be very, very careful when you're adding revenue and you're not sure if that's going to be there. I've seen that. I've gone through many budgets, and I've seen where they've added revenue. Oh, sales tax was going to be up, and they added the revenue, and guess what? In 2005, there was a 35% tax increase, and that was followed by a 12% tax increase. And that was what it was about, is people adding revenue. We could add revenue to pay for this. We'll just add that we can get more revenue a year. So you have to be very careful with that. And that's what I'm trying to point out. So I'm less inclined to do the revenue. I'm more inclined to say, get the money and, run it through the property taxes. Right now we have a zero property tax and we're running through. And I, like Legislator Gavaris, I don't, the idea of keep on having 0% tax increases isn't really good in the long time, because now we have, we're running out our fund balances when we should be actually pumping into those fund balances if we can, if we have the ability, or at least not taking them out. So, I mean, I'm less inclined to do the revenue from Airbnb and more inclined to do the revenue just added on the sales tax, I mean, the property tax then.
Okay, Legislative Walter and then Ronk.
So I wanted to also speak to Legislator Bartel's question. I mean, what I'm particularly concerned will happen with all of these cuts is what I had suggested before. DSS will just make less referrals. They'll just reduce their ask because they'll recognize that there's not enough. You see when your caseworkers and other providers are full up and they are serving too many people, and then you start diverting it. And so it might be much more subtle than it seems, but it's going to deplete the whole system. It's not as blatant all the time as just cutting jobs, but it'll deplete the system in also other subtle ways.
Okay, thank you for that. Legislative Ronk?
Thank you. Again, I'm not speaking as much in my comments about the value of the program. I tend to agree, you know, three quarters of the way with Dave. Overestimating revenues or being too generous with revenues is, you know, a recipe for disaster when you're budgeting. Of course, everything is an estimate. But I think, A, it's rampant speculation to say that, you know, any increases from a Airbnb voluntary collection agreement would make up the difference in, you know, to a positive for the occupancy tax. And quite frankly, I don't agree. I've never agreed with the numbers that have been put out by either, you know, former comptroller Auerbach or, our current comptroller Gallagher on Airbnb revenue. I think it fails to take into account monies that we already receive through occupancy taxes that are paid by the hosts themselves, the way this is supposed to happen. Again, because a lot of that information on how much tax they pay is proprietary, only Bert can know, and he'd go to the clink if he told us. I think that we should be careful, you know, in estimating higher for the first year when we have a voluntary collection agreement, you know, and then, you know, I would rather be delivered a happy surprise than, you know, delivered a big bill to pay at the end.
Okay. Any other? Yes. Legislator Criswell.
Since the comptroller is on the line, can we ask her to chime in?
Comptroller Gallagher, can you weigh in on this? Perhaps she's not on the line. Okay. We'll have to do a follow-up with her, Peter.
Sounds great. Just as a last thought, you know, again, we're talking about social services programs. We're talking about youth that are at risk. We're talking about families that are at risk. So I understand the complexities of what we're talking about, found money, not found money, that type of thing. But I just think we have to put the programs in the forefront and figure this out.
No, thank you for that. Anybody else?
You guys, I'm here. I'm sorry I stepped away for a moment.
That's okay. So you didn't hear the conversation. You want to restate your question, Peter?
Yeah, we were talking about the realities of Airbnb money coming in to the county in 2021.
I think there's high occupancy at Airbnbs right now, and I think there's a signed agreement that's supposed to go into effect December 1. So I think that we're going to see revenues coming in directly from Airbnb for 2021.
And do you have any guesstimations on that?
I don't separate out from our regular occupancy tax. I can just tell you that occupancy tax is not down as much as you would expect right now. I'd have to go back and look at the exact amount. But I would have expected a bigger decline than what we're seeing. It's not off that much.
Bert, you seem to have a difference of opinion
it
in
is,
your facial expressions.
Because I break it out each quarter. It's 23% down the last quarter. I mean, it's factual. And the quarter before that, if you just give me 1 second.
So is that for the year, Bert?
No, that's just down? Lynn, just the last quarter because...
Well, can you give us it in aggregate? Yep. What is it from a yearly? Because I think that's
right
more
here.
Relevant.
Through the third quarter, which ends in October, we were down 30% compared to 2019. And 2019, our total was $2 million.
Okay.
I just wanted to say thank you for considering funding these important programs.
Could I just add one final word, if I might?
Quickly, yes. We have an extensive agenda.
So I understand the fiscal difficulties. Quite aside from the human cost that is at stake here, this is a matter of pay now or pay later. Because clearly, when there is a reduction in these types of services, they are bound to result, particularly in this COVID-19 crisis, in greater abuse, greater neglect, and the ensuing cost to the taxpayer later on. Thank you, and please, please consider restoring this cut.
Thank you for that reminder. Appreciate it. Okay. Okay, so now we're going to move on to assigned counsel, legislators Walter and Haynes. I'll take a motion to discuss assigned counsel program. Thank you. Second?
Negative.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So for those of you who are not fully familiar, I'll just briefly summarize what assigned counsel program does. It's actually, there is an executive law connected to this, the expectation that all individuals who cannot afford counsel get counsel. And while we have a public defender's office and it's a little different system in every county and every place, the assigned counsel program is intended to provide counsel when there's a conflict of interest. So for example, a family court situation, how it's described, you can't have, if neither partners can afford an attorney, you can't have two people from the same public defender's office, one supporting the husband and one supporting the wife. It is by law that we provide what these are called conflict defenders, which if there's a conflict of interest, they provide the defense. But it's been done in different kinds of ways. It's been done, some of it is in a partnership with Dutchess County where we do theirs, they do ours. It's a little different in different courts. It is the Office of Indigenous Legal Services desire that every county has established an assigned counsel program, a sophisticated assigned counsel program that has an administrator, at least an administrator who administrates this program. There are several different models. It could be done by a nonprofit organization or it could be done by the county government. Legislator Haynes and I are proposing this to be done within county government, creating its own department. They do not want this, many places, and we weren't the only ones, had it under their public defender's office or somewhere else it wasn't allowed. They kind of all noticed somehow, maybe June, that we were all putting it in the wrong place. So right now, Dutchess is scrambling to figure out their plan, Westchester. There's a lot of other counties in the same place. So the ILS's ideal scenario is it's a standalone department. Right now, what we have is a placeholder. We have a part-time administrator put under finance. And Bert, maybe you could speak to it. ILS has in their paperwork that we put in for a part-time administrator assistant too, but I didn't see that in, you know, there's the difference between what was asked for permission versus what we put in our system, but they have already approved a half-time administrator and a half-time administrative assistant on the state side. Legislator Haynes and I are requesting that these are two full-time positions. They will be funded by ILS. ILS has a cap, but when they analyzed how much we have already been asking for year two and year three, they have identified that this add-on would not exceed the cap, and for the following year, it'll be even hot, you know, goes up every year. So they do not see a reason why they cannot cover the costs for these positions given what the county has already asked for. So this gives us a chance to create a model assigned council program. Again, just for those of you who don't know, this means then that there can be a panel of attorneys, those who really understand felony law, those who understand family court, so that this administrator can pull on people who know what they're doing. Also, those people who are located on one end of our county versus the other, that knowing who these attorneys are, knowing what they're capable of, so that anybody in any of our courts who needs counsel, who cannot be supported by the public defender's office, will have someone at high caliber. And again, fully state funded. And I don't know if there's anything else to add yet.
Sorry, Bert.
Yeah, you were on mute, Lynn. Eve, I agree with you. Just in terms of the process, we would need to amend the budget with the state, because right now we just have that part-time assigned counsel administrator in there. So it is something we'd have to do in the process. And I will say, you know, it would, one thing too is I have over $1 million of those assigned counsel expenses in my budget. So we'd have to work with, you know, this assigned counsel administrator anyway. Like I said, I'm all for that setup. It's just a matter of we would have to amend the state kind of budget too.
Thank you. And yeah. And just on that, and they did look at what you already put in to ensure that this add-on would be able to be covered, because they do have a cap. So it would be covered.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And they're ready for it. I mean, they actually thanked us, Legislator Haynes and I, for doing this, because this is something that they are very much standing behind. As far as its departments, and I don't know, Amber and I have been working on, there's two different paths to figuring out how to make its own independent department. I'll just explain the path, and Amber, if you want to add anything. So it needs to be its own department. We have on our charter the Department of Community Corrections that happens to include on one of the elements this job description. It's a much broader department, because it really deals with individuals who are incarcerated, but it has, like in section B2, the assigned counsel 18B position. So one idea is, we does it make more sense to put it in that department, but then change the name, because we don't want it in community corrections, but because the description is already there, would that make sense to move it there and then just do the whatever work? And I'm a freshman, so I am open, whatever work to change it, or we keep it in finance, do the work it takes to create a specific department of assigned counsel and then move it. And so I don't have a preference. I made the promise to ILS that we will do the path that will get it to a department as quickly as possible. And that's all they ask for, is that it does get there, but whichever way.
Okay. Chairman Donaldson had a question, so let's see.
Yes.
I mean, that's a technical thing we can work out later, but let's get to the questions.
Yeah, I mean, my mind, it would have to be a department of its own created. I don't think it makes sense using an old department and then shifting everything around. It doesn't take that much to do that. I mean, it takes, I don't mean to say it's nothing to do, but I mean it, because there is a lot of, you know, work to do with through the finance department, you know, get the line numbers and the item numbers. So, and I think in the end, this would actually save money, because right now, you're not going to have these people assigned the same way. So I really think this would probably end up, you know, saving money and being more effective in a way of delivering assigned counsel. I always like to equate it to something like the John Gavaris and Ken Ronco out and rob the bank. And what happens is, you know, they're eligible for the public defender. And as a result, maybe John gets the public defender, but Ken doesn't get it. You'll have to have an assigned counsel. That's the way I kind of describe it. I like to use we make John and Ron the criminal, John and Ken the criminals today. But I think that makes sense, that with this, rather than having just an administrator, you know, fighting down to look for people all the time, when they'll have them all signed up and ready to roll. So, and I think it's cost effective. And I think, you know, for criminal justice purposes, more effective for both if it's the victim and the perpetrator, shall we say.
Bert, and then Legislator Guevaras.
In terms of creating the department, what I normally do is contact the state comptroller, because they do have the chart of accounts, and this department may have its own separate number, so it's not a big deal, and you know, we'll find the appropriate number and use that going forward, because that's what would be reported to the state.
Thanks. Amber started looking at that process as well.
Legislator Guevaras?
I just understand you're mentioning that this is a preference of theirs, but it's not a requirement currently, is it?
So they, it's interesting. There is an executive law that there is an assigned counsel program articulated like the plan. It's sort of an unfunded mandate. There's not a specific like penalty if you don't have it, but they do have that. With an expectation that every county has this assigned counsel plan. I guess more that they put their money behind it, and that once you have it, they will support the funding for it.
Why can't the plan be the same plan for both Ulster and Dutchess County that we swap?
Dutchess is working on their whole other, so this is the way they do it we have no administrator. It's just sort of a handshake agreement, and it's not every court. It's just some, and Dutchess is reworking their own, so it's not quite clear. It might be that we still utilize Dutchess attorneys when needed, if not here, but ideally we have Ulster attorneys who are being, you know, who are providing this kind of service here as well. But everyone's in the process of adapting their model.
Okay. Legislator Ronk.
Thanks. Maybe I missed something in being off of the, you know, law enforcement committee for a couple of years. Just back to Legislator Guevaras' question, I didn't think that the 18B council, you know, that this change was going to eliminate using conflict defender. We have a conflict defender, usually one of our folks in Dutchess and one of Dutchess's folks in ours. It doesn't completely eliminate, you know, the need to use 18B counsel, but it reduced 18B expenses by a great deal over the last several years. So we're not eliminating that, are we?
No, you still have a conflict.
Okay.
It's kind of confusing because there's the assigned counsel administrator. Then what the service is the conflict defender, right? I mean,
right.
It's a little confusing. The conflict defender is sort of the institutional provider, this is someone who, because really in their, it's attached in here, they have a much bigger vision of what it could be, including training attorneys who, to provide better services for indigent people. Like there's a lot more writing grants and identifying ways to expand services. So, you know, there's a vision of what more it can be beyond the conflict defender.
Yeah, and I that makes me feel better, but I also, you know, this is a much better way to handle assigned counsel than it was previously, because previously assigned counsel was whomever the judges liked the best would get these, you know, plum, you know, payments for 18B, you know, counsel.
Right, and they may or may not be skilled enough to
Correct.
Provide that. I just want to add, Bert, the big thing with ILS is they will not supplant a position. They will only expand. And they had on record that at one point, I think it was that we had with maybe Deborah Schneer, someone put in this position. And I said, if that's true, it was like 5-10 years ago that we are not supplanting anything by this. So I just wanted to raise your attention.
Yeah.
I said we are not supplanting, but I just wanted to
We had a contract with Deborah Schneer just to try to get this program off the ground.
Okay.
And that was years ago. It wasn't a position.
Perfect. Yep. So that I just wanted to make sure
yep.
you knew their concern, and I assured them I have
no
planting of a job that this is suggesting.
Okay, any other questions on this? Okay, not seeing any. Let's move on to Legislative Walter and Haynes, Black Creek. I'll take a motion to move for discussion.
So moved.
Second? Thank you. Okay, there you go.
Legislator Haynes, do you want to start this or do you want me to?
You can go right ahead. Thank you.
Sure. So during our law enforcement and public safety meeting, the sheriff came to us and said quite clearly, and he's expressed it in several other times, I think at Ways and Means meetings and others, that their Black Creek system, which covers the doors locking and the cameras, is pretty antiquated in several ways. The last upgrade was in 2011. It utilizes a lot of old operating systems, and so when they do have parts that break, often they can't replace them because the newer systems aren't compatible. They often, he used the words, cannibalize from other parts to help this, but they're constantly doing these repairs. It's getting harder and harder for them to find the parts for this system because of its age, and that it's being undergoing repairs pretty much weekly. And this controls the locks for all the doors and the cameras. And so it's a safety issue, a safety concern. And so I also wanted to point out that and I don't know if I remembered to put this up here, but the sheriff's cuts from 2020 to 2021 were pretty comprehensive. I mean, it was pretty close. I have it somewhere, but I don't have it right here. That when I kind of looked, I mean, this is a hard one because we're trying to sort of balance as much as possible. But if we put this back in, his reduction from 2020 is still similar to what other departments have to do. That makes sense. That his reductions were so much that if this was even added in, he's still showing a reduction from 2020 that's relatively similar to others. And but he has expressed very clearly to Legislator Haynes and I and the rest of the committee how important this is and the potential crisis that could happen if the system fully breaks down, and the reduction of cost in annually with a newer system. I don't know if you want to add anything, Legislator Haynes, to that.
So just for my edification, I think originally his cuts were in the 800,000 or something like that. Is that what it was? I remember it was, I think it was out to be somewhere in the millions, but I don't think in the end it was. I think it was slightly less than a million. Go ahead.
Casey might be able to answer. I mean, there's several different places, so it did look like it was still more than a million, but Tracy, do you have that? I have it, but I have to go find it.
No, I have it, but I'm wondering, can I just ask, isn't this proposal a proposal for a capital program?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't even translate exactly directly either. Do you know what I mean?
To savings, right.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess my point was more philosophical, that he's made some major, major reductions, and the optics of saying that we're putting in more in the jail, it should be countered by how much we are taking from the system, even if it's not a same-same. It's that concept that he is making a lot of reductions in his budget.
Amber, do you have the numbers?
I just wanted to point out on this, because I just pulled I have the amendment in front of me, that total budgetary change to revenues is just wrong. That's just pointing to something that it wasn't supposed to. So I'm going to correct that, and it'll be corrected moving forward.
How much is it?
So since this is a capital project, it would be bonded for. So there would be revenue at the time that the project's established, which is separate approval by the legislature.
Okay. Legislator Ronk?
Thanks. Just to answer, I think your question about what the sheriff savings is, The number he shared with me was in the area, this morning, was in the area of $1.2 million.
That sounds
Thank you. So there were additional additional savings. Okay. Thank you. All right. Any Legislator Bartels?
Thank you. I'm just wondering if we were to move forward on this capital, we just moved this month, didn't we just move a Black Creek contract, one of these smaller fixes, right? Would that, if the sheriff knew that this were coming, would we be able to hold off on that one, or does he have to, he have to maintain
the
new system?
She's waiting for the bus again.
Sounds like she was drinking.
We can ask the, I think we can ask the sheriff. I think it depends on how quickly it moves. And maybe Bert knows a little bit more. I do know, so I think it depends.
Yeah. That was a maintenance agreement. We went for 40-some thousand, right?
Right. Yeah. If they're going in and immediately upgrading it, it might be different. But go ahead, Bert.
Yeah, I just want to, in terms of the process for this project, the sheriff would still have to come to the legislature next year, which would, the earliest probably would be February. So this will take time to implement this this capital project. Just, you know, again, to make the committee aware of that as well.
So there's no real savings? Is that what you're saying?
Over time, it will. Once it's implemented, there will be, but it's going to take time to get there.
Okay.
I'll add that this would then prevent the 2021 ask for another $60,000 because they have to find a way to repair it again.
Got it. Legislator Guevaras.
Well, was this evaluated to say like this is the best option, is just upgrading the software rather than looking at potential new system or something else? How was that done, or was it done?
Well, yeah. So a new system is over $2 million and for one. For two, the whole Sheriff's Association is a bit peeved right now that Black Creek is the sole provider of this. If anyone out there is listening and you are capable of developing this, you'd make a lot of money in New York because there's only one competitor. And so this will hold them for 5 years or so before, you know, they'll need to really think what they're going to do next. I think ideally they would love to have a whole new system, but there is no such whole new system yet, except if we were to put in for $2 million and give them a complete new one. But he's not asking for a complete new one.
Well, I guess my point of that is, though, you're saying the savings is over a few years. Maybe the savings is even greater by bonding $2 million versus only $630,000.
Probably it is. It's a hard thing to ask during this particular year's budget and this time of pandemic, but I'm sure this sheriff, I don't know how he would feel. I mean, again, I know that he's frustrated with the fact that this is currently the only vendor, that he may prefer to just have this for now until there's some other options. But, you know, at the same time, I think if it was a choice of $2 million or nothing, he'll take a new system. I mean, one way or another, he wants a system that works.
Chairman Donaldson.
Well, it's right now it's a little hard for me to swallow without really seeing the numbers on how it's actually going to be saving money in the long run. I'd like to see what they're spending on the repairs on a regular basis and how this would actually save that, and will it actually save all those? And I have, like Legislator Guevaras, I would like to, you know, get a handle on would it make sense to actually go to the whole new system, because once you bond for it, and how long will this work? If we put the 630 in there, if it only lasts for, if you're telling me, I thought I heard you say it might be good for 5 years. So I don't know how that would be a savings from the fixing as they go along. If it's only going to be the 630 is only going to cover something to fix it for 5 years. Yeah. I don't know. Did I hear that?
Yeah, the justification explains that this upgrade would stabilize the system for 4 to 5 years and that the cost, the change of maintenance costs would go from $57,000 a year to $20,000. The other cost, which we can't put a dollar on, is should the system break down, there's a fire and an inmate gets injured or killed. And that amount we don't have in there, but we do know it'll reduce the maintenance costs by more than half. And yes, he does not believe this will stabilize the system for necessarily more than 5 years.
Legislator Guevaras.
Can I ask Berg, what are we currently bonding rates right now? What are we currently seeing?
Actually, I was actually just going to calculate kind of an estimate of what the annual bonding cost would be on the 630. Just if you bear with me like 2 minutes, I'll get back.
Do you know the percentage rate? I was just curious to that.
It's roughly 2.5.
2.5%? Okay.
Yeah.
So just so everyone's aware, for somebody that's purchasing like me, that right now with everything going on, one of the good side effects is companies that sell softwares, equipment, they're selling things now at 0% financing, and they'll hold the note on these things for up to 60 months most places. So if it's a huge expense, I'd have to figure out the math on the, you know, 2.5% savings compared to the 2 million, but, you know, there might be some pickup there. And then the window might get a little narrower there.
Wouldn't this be bonded for 5 years, Bert?
Yeah, Dave, it would be the useful life of 5 years, yes. It would be bonded if it's 5 years in terms of the useful life, yes. It would be bonded for the 5 years.
Well, that's so I don't see if we're paying $27,000 a year now for repairs. Is that correct?
57.
Oh, we're paying 57. Okay. And the bond would be.
It's roughly $135,000 a year for the 5 years.
Right. So I don't see the savings.
Legislator Ronk.
Not to speak for anybody, but it seems that one of the estimations is that the $50,000 is not going to be, you know, the number over the next 5 years. The thought, I think, Legislator Donaldson, is that, you know, the maintenance costs would conceivably increase to the point where it would cost more than that for the entire term. I'm not saying I agree with that statement, but I think that that's where some of the idea comes from.
Legislator Haynes.
And one thing to take into consideration is that when Deputy Howe came in, Officer Howe came in, and he explained this to our committee, it's very hard to find the parts to fix this. It's like he doesn't have a boneyard to continually go to fix. I think it was that, or was that the computer systems, actually?
I thought that was the fire alarm system.
No, that was this system. He was cannibalizing from other things in order.
Yeah, and so he's having an increasingly hard time to get these parts. And I mean, it kind of sounded like really, you know, very antiquated system, very hard to find replacement parts, and it's definitely in need of an upgrade or a replacement or something.
Can I just add to that, that if this is a fully upgraded system, that also makes parts more accessible, because most of the parts that are available are for upgraded systems. New parts, just like, you know, with your computers, new parts don't work with old systems all the time. And so this upgrade would make that more accessible. So it might extend even more than the 5 years. You know, this is the last 5 years, or 9 years, but that's with a really, really old system.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you. All right, Legislative Walter, we're moving on to Chief Diversity Officer. I'll take a motion for discussion.
So moved.
Second, thank you, Chairman Donaldson. All right.
So this is Legislator Haynes and I. So just a little history. This position of a diversity officer within the sheriff's office came out of the task force, the reform task force that the legislative one that was formed by resolution from Chair Donaldson, and in response to police reform. And the idea was that a few areas to respond to police reform. One is increasing the recruitment of individuals who are not typically represented in law enforcement, people of color, women, other people. And so
the idea would be that this person would be doing active recruitment. Also, one of the challenges is that in the world of law enforcement, typically the people who pass through recruitment and going to school and passing and becoming officers have someone in their family that they know who's already an officer who helps them know how to study for the test and how to prepare for interviews. So this first, a lot of these people, especially people of color, women and others, don't have access to that kind of support system so to ensure their success all the way through. And so this person would also help in what we call the retention of individuals who are typically underrepresented. They'd also support implicit bias trainings and be there as a part of the law enforcement that really recognizes the significance of discrimination. That said, initially we put this in, there was a diversity officer, a chief diversity person for the county in 2020 budget, and conversations with the executive's office, this position wasn't filled and wasn't filled and wasn't filled. And at last I had heard in mid-October that someone was offered the job. They had till the end of October, but it's been weeks and they hadn't answered. And so when we put this in, when Legislator Haynes and I put this in, the position in our knowledge had not been filled. So we're just going to suggest, you know what, for 2021, let's take it out of the county, put it in the sheriff's office, do this one that sort of connects with this you know, discrimination and law enforcement issues that are coming up in response to the governor's mandate, and see how successful it is, and then maybe work on 2022 having a county-wide, or maybe DSS needs its own, or, you know, maybe there needs to be one that's really centered on each type of department, because recruitment, retention, and knowledge of implicit bias depends. It's different in the health department than it is in DSS than the sheriff. That said, now we found out like 2 days ago that they hired. So our intent is to pull this, but we felt, following the advice of our chair, Donaldson, is like, it's sometimes better to put it out there and then pull it so that you all have it on your radar, so that you all know this is something we want to achieve. Obviously, if there's overwhelming desire that we keep it in, we'll happily do it, but this, you know, we only found out like yesterday or the day before that the person was, the person literally was hired 2 days ago. So so it's our intent to pull it.
Was it an outside hire or someone inside?
I believe it's an outside hire, Lynn. And it was the start date was just Monday, November 16th, as far as I know.
Thank you. But okay. We're not going to give up on this.
Well, and maybe it's a good conversation to have with the new diversity officer, right?
Well, this person needs to be someone who has law enforcement experience. It's very necessary to the job that they actually have that part of that world, because you can't really recruit and retain and prepare somebody to succeed in that world if you don't know it yourself.
Uh-huh.
Be that person, but hopefully we'll find a way. There's a second position that the task force came up with in terms of officer mental health, and we didn't put that through because the federal government does have grants to support that particular job, so we're going to try to seek funding for that one, and who knows, maybe we can find federal money that can help support this one as well.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes, I think now that you hired the new person, I'd like to see them, you know, at some point report to the Laws and Rules Committee, and the personnel goes to them just for a conversation, so we, you know, meet the person, know, you know, what their approach is going to be and so on. Is that all right with you, Bert? All right, thank you.
Chairman Donaldson, it really isn't my decision, but
no, I know that. That's true.
Yeah.
I'll talk to Pat. I got to talk to him anyway today.
Thank you.
I got to call him back. All right, thanks.
Okay, then next we have Legislator Ronk and Haynes, Public Health Director of COVID Ops. Can I have that move for discussion?
I'll move it.
Second. Thank you. Go
Go Thanks. Ahead. Just a little background on this. You know, Mark Ryder had come to me and asked me to sponsor this. Dan Proctor has been heading up the county's COVID response pretty much since the beginning. Back when this all started with Pat's, you know, executive orders and some, you know, emergency powers that he has because of the state of emergency, he had hired Dan out of the Department of Information Services. The deputy director of information services was vacant at that point, and needing somebody to be able to quarterback the county's response, you know, that's where he was able to find the money at that time. It now is necessary to hire a deputy director of information services, and it makes a lot more sense to have the director of COVID response out of the health department, obviously. So that's basically what this amendment does. It uses, among other sources of revenue, to make it budget neutral, a supervising public health nurse, which they've been trying to hire and have been unable to find somebody to fill the position. You know, I just want to say, on behalf of the person who would be taking this job, it's a 1-year position. It's not intended to be renewed the following year. Knock on wood. As long as we can, you know, as a you know, county, state, and nation, dig ourselves out of this mess within the next year. But I can just say that, you know, as a county, we've been doing extraordinarily well with the COVID response, and I think that Dan's leadership at the health department is a really big part of it. And I just, you know, I don't think that we cannot have somebody whose whole job it is to, you know, do all of the things that are necessary to make sure that everyone stays safe and healthy. And Heidi, I don't know if you want to jump in and add anything.
I just really want to reiterate that Dan's role in, you know, running the whole back end of these COVID and the numbers, and it's such a niche, and he's really worked very, very hard. There's not a lot of other people who can, you know, perform this function, and it's very important that we create some type of an avenue that we can have him stay on so that he can continue to perform this vital role. And I really believe it's very critical.
Chairman Donaldson, then Legislator Guevaras,
then Walter. So this is basically a part-time position then, or it's full-time,
It's a full-time position, but, you know, it's not, you know, as long as, you know, things improve, it's not intended to be a long-term position.
No, I understand that, but I see what you're saying. So you're saying this is only for like 6 months.
It's funded through the year.
At 24,000?
No, at 96.
96,000.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right.
The 24,000 is part of the revenue offset, Dave. Or part of the, it's an expense offset, I apologize. It's not a.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Legislator Guevaras, then Walter.
You mentioned the public health nurse. I thought that was grant funded and it could only be used for that purpose. Is that something different I'm thinking of?
That position is in a separate division. It's not these positions, John. This is a separate supervising public health nurse
that we already have funding for.
Right, and it's vacant, and they have had a hard time filling any of those.
It would be county funded, is what.
Correct. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
We're just moving one money from one pot to the other.
Right. Okay. And I will just add, it's not just dealing with the COVID now. You got to remember, if, you know, knock on wood, we do have vaccines. Someone's going to have to organize the distribution for that as well.
Absolutely.
So just to keep that too.
So if miracles happen, this is all over by, school time next year, we're still going to have this person till the end of the year regardless? Or is it going to be situational?
It's going to be situational. If he's no longer needed by September, then I believe that's a decision the administration would have at that point on if there was something else he needed to do prior to the end of the year, or if we, you know, part ways and have savings.
And my only last thing is more of a comment. I would think while a lot of the focus is going to be health related, I would say this person pretty much should actually be through emergency management because they are going to be touching multiple departments, and putting them into health department, I don't think you'll get as much cooperation as you would as emergency management, because it's going to work with municipalities, it's going to work with everybody. I think you may want to reconsider where you put that.
All right, thanks, John.
So, Legislative Walter?
Yeah, I have a couple. First of just, if you could just clarify, I mean, was the position put in for 2021 at 71,454, and you're looking to give them a raise of 24,794 to put them at a salary of 96? That's the first part of this. Is that what the...
No, so the 71,494 is the salary of a supervising public health nurse. The new position of director of COVID operations is $96,000. So that's where the other offsets come from. It's not the same position. It wasn't put into the budget as, you know, as X. So I guess the money in the budget at 71,454, that is in the budget, but it's as a supervising public health nurse. Dan's not operating as a supervising public health nurse.
And he had the IS title, and then so this would also mean putting in someone in that position?
Correct. One of the reasons for the swap, other than, you know, that it makes a lot more sense to have the position here than an IS. One of the reasons for the swap is because they are in need of hiring a deputy director of information services. We've lost several people at information services over the last year. And, you know, there's a gap that needs to be filled in our technology department.
But that's, since it's not on this, I guess.
No, that's separate. Yeah, he would be vacating the deputy director's position. So the deputy director's position is still in the budget with this amendment.
Thank you. So that's the first part, was that I was trying to put my head around. So here's, I guess I would like to know more about what this position would actually be doing and where we are with COVID right now. And, I'm in the health world, and I spoke to people who are in the, you know, the delivery of care. I went to spend an hour and a half, and we had a county talk on distribution of vaccines for counties in New York State. I mean, a lot of the, you know, the rollout that's expected to happen, the first stage of it is going to go directly to the healthcare centers to provide people who are, you know, healthcare workers and emergency responders, which is, if you want to know, happening planned for December. And then the next level moves to working with those healthcare providers to distribute the vaccines to higher risk people. But it's, again, going right to the health centers who for months now are working with the state. I mean, they have a plan pretty well in place, working with the state. You know, these medical centers, these community health centers have to talk about having the freezer in place and how many people they're going to serve. So the distribution of the vaccine is going to be primarily for the next 6 months through the community-based health centers, some hospitals, eventually some pharmacies that have the capacity. The state has put together a call system, a data resource system. And so unlike when COVID first hit us and we didn't have everything in place, we didn't have time to put it, we were figuring it out in the county on our own. Now, for months, the state is putting their vaccine distribution plan, like, it's pretty strong and solid. That doesn't mean they're not going to need some support on a county level, but it's not even clear to them yet what they're going to need us to do to help this process. They're not sure yet. There are ways the county can get in the way, you know, like if we have a call center and they have a call center and it's not providing the same information. So I really would love to be clear what this person would really do, considering the very solid statewide plan for vaccine distribution right now.
Do we have a job description, Bert, on this?
Lynn, I'm not sure. I don't believe so, but I'm sure I can get the duties to this committee.
Ken, did Mark provide you with a job description for this?
He did not, but I'm gonna ask him to provide one to the committee.
Okay. because I think that hopefully could answer some of Legislator Walter's questions. Chairman Donaldson, and then Legislator Haynes.
Yeah, this is going to be a pretty involved process. I know the state has been working very hard at making sure that it's going to be done as best as possible, but on the county level, we need somebody that's going to be coordinating on the county level. And I've already had these conversations also with the county executive. And somebody like Dan has had this type of experience of coordinating these to something of that nature. So, I mean, it's going to be not an easy thing to do, even with full state support. It's still going to have to, you know, you're going to have people that know this county inside out in order to be able to do the processes, process these quickly and, in the most, expeditious manner and making sure that those that need it most first get it first. So it's not going to be a very easy task. And I really think that I would rather err on the side of making sure that they're out there and they're out there quick.
Okay, Legislator Haynes and then Walter.
Yeah, although I can't speak to the vaccination, we're not quite there yet, but yeah, that's going to be a huge rollout. But I totally agree. That's what I was going to say. There's such a coordinated effort here. And although the state does play a role in this, there's just so much that goes on within the county that needs to be done. I mean, every day, you know, even just with the COVID currently, you know, the county is uploading all of the information, combining it, you know, with, you know, the state numbers. And there's just a lot of stuff that's going on behind the scenes that's going to need continual support and a definite coordinated effort moving forward on both levels.
Okay, so Legislative Walter, Bartels, then Ronk.
Yeah, just to clarify again, it's, you know, coordinating what is what I need clarity about, because once again, the vaccine distribution is happening through the medical centers. They have already been worked, that's who has to. There's special freezers that are used. They have to have them. Many of them are buying them. I don't know if DOH even has the freezer that it needs to have, but you know, that the first three stages of vaccine distribution is really happening through our health centers, who, by the way, they're community health centers. They know our population very well. They deliver them vaccines all the time. They give them health care. You need to have two shots, so you need to be able to have continuity of care with these individuals. And so it's not just that the state's involved. They are working directly. They just got a call. You know, there was a whole application process that all of the health centers had to put through. They had to identify how many people they serve and who they serve and where they serve. So that vaccine, one day when we have a ton of vaccines, which will be maybe 6-7 months from now, if the community center, the healthcare centers cannot keep up with that, we might need those pop-up tents to deliver it to larger people, but we won't know that for 6-7 months. At this stage, though, the vaccine distribution is happening by the healthcare centers, as it should. And so I'm not questioning whether there needs to be coordination. I just want to be clear what coordination this position would do, because it's not about vaccine distribution. And so I just want to know what it is that it's going to be about. I don't doubt there must be something, but it's not going to be about vaccine distribution, because vaccine distribution is already being coordinated with these medical centers.
Legislator Bartels.
Thank you. Hopefully my sound works. The job description would be very helpful for me too. And I just have one question. What is this person getting currently in the IS position?
It's that salary.
Salary.
As the deputy of IS, correct.
Okay, so we're moving that salary to this job description.
Correct.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just follow?
Wait a second. We had Legislator Ron as a follow-up. Then you can chime in.
If Legislator Walter's question is related to what Legislator Bartels was just talking about, I'd be happy to let her go first.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I just wanted to add, so is the IS position at the same amount?
I do want to speak about the IS, though, if I could, because it's on that topic. Because my understanding was that that position was a joint leadership position. And when Jose left, we kept both of those as a leadership. Now it's defined as deputy, or was it always defined as deputy?
It was always, I think, defined as deputy.
Yeah, it was always a deputy director of IS.
Even though they were both making the same money, right? Weren't they both?
No, the director did make more.
Okay. All right. Sorry, Ken. Go ahead.
That's okay. I just, you know, to Legislator Walter's point, you know, I don't disagree with any of the statements that she's made, you know, about vaccine distribution, but you know, this isn't a director of vaccine distribution. I want to make it clear that's not, you know, that's not what I don't think the executive's office is saying, that it's only about distributing the vaccine. That, I think, comes later. I think that was a point that Bert made as to, you know, what might be happening 8 months down the road. You know, but for right now, as to what they'd be coordinating, things like the COVID hotline, which I think in the coming weeks is going to be increasing in the number of calls. You know, we may need to start up more things like Project Resilience. It may need to come in a different manner than it was in the spring and summer, because now we're going to have people who are cold and hungry in the winter, and we're going to have to find ways, you know, to shelter people who would normally be sheltering with like Catholic Charities and whatnot, that we may not be able to congregate in a large hall like that. So, you know, in addition to that, you know, you've got contact tracing, which is going to increase in need and decrease in, you know, ease and ability. You know, there's a lot of things with the COVID response that Dan has been heading up that I think we're going to seriously need. I'm sure some people have seen the county executive's press release about, you know, the numbers, you know, spiking today, reducing the number of people allowed at the county office building. You know, we're obviously in the midst of the second wave now, not at the beginning. And so anyway, I think the job description, when Mark provides that to the committee, is going to provide some clarity to the committee on, you know, exactly what he'll be coordinating. But those are several of the things. And the last thing on vaccine distribution in the state, and I've got very little confidence in the state when they decide that they're going to coordinate something. You know, I've seen, you know, something in emergency services like the statewide information network, or SWIN, where the state was going to create after 9/11 a communication system for all emergency responders in New York State. And it was somewhere 2008, 2009. They spent $1 billion on it, flipped the switch. It didn't work. And they said, oh, well, it's up to you guys now, counties. And that's why we still have a crappy VHF you know, radio system in the county, because the state said that they were going to handle it.
They sent everybody two tin cans and a string. That was their system.
Exactly.
All right, Ken, you'll try and make sure we get it, Ken or Bert, before we decision this on Tuesday. Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay, Legislator Wolf.
Yeah, thanks. And I do appreciate that, Legislator Wrong. I will say that this is how it was presented to us by the executive specifically for vaccine. So that's where I got it from. I guess my other piece of the concern, and Legislator Guevara alluded to it, is we did get funding for contact tracing for public health nurses. Now I hear that we're not able to fill those positions, but like there is federal funding to cover doing a lot of this work. And we also, when we approved that we put a placeholder for another $1 million, that there is an expectation, we don't know for sure, but that there will be revenue to the counties, the state and then the counties, to do what the next need is. Before it was contact tracing and how it's shifting. So I guess I'm concerned about, are we sure we're not expending the revenue first that we're getting? If we haven't filled these positions, you know, the idea is this person is responsible for contact tracing as one key element of those other positions. Can we confirm that this kind of position couldn't be covered by that revenue? Because I know the way the contract was written, it had to be a public health nurse who does contact tracing. But is there any flexibility with that? Because again, the money's there and we're not spending it because we haven't filled it. So, and there's potentially going to be more money to do these positions. So the second part of the question is, if we already have somebody and this money comes in, will we be able to apply it to this position, or will it have to be a new hire? For the public health nurses, it couldn't be someone we already had. It had to be a new hire. So we might lose our chances of using that revenue for a new hire if we do this. So again, those are several of my questions.
Legislator Bartels.
Can I just ask a question? I don't know if anyone here would know the answer, but in terms of those kind of requirements about not supplanting positions, does that apply if you have a contracted position? If for example, you're contracting with an outside person to do a job, and then you fill the position as a county position, does that count as supplanting? You're saying no, Eve, is that correct?
It kind of depends on the specifics of the grant. I mean, there's a lot of times where they have to be positions and you couldn't supplant from services provided before, whether via contract. It really is the terms of the grant. It's not just an overall kind of a thing. And with this one, they were pretty specific about the positions needed and not supplanting, but it's one of those we definitely could follow up, but I don't believe that the director of COVID would fall under that.
Can I ask also, and I, again, I don't know if anyone here can answer the question, but given that we're talking about creating a position for no more than a year, has there been any discussion about contracting the services for 1 year rather than creating a county position that's going to be terminated by agreement at the end of 1 year?
Bert?
Sorry, this is where my friends at the IRS have issues with this, because if this is a position that IRS could look at as it should be a position, we can get fined, and they have done reviews before.
But this isn't a permanent position. This is because we're in the middle of a crisis.
Don't we contract nurses? Don't we contract?
Yeah.
Understood, but we contract nurses for this, and I hear you, but it is one thing to be careful of, because the IRS has done audits on us before, and there is the potential to get fined for that as well.
I just want to say, does Bert have friends at the IRS?
I wish I did.
Yeah.
Legislative Walter. Oh, I'm sorry. You want to finish up?
I'm just going to answer Tracy's.
Yeah, that would. Yeah.
I'll be quick. So for this particular funding, I mean, we did have contract public health nurses who we were able to supplant with in-house people. They couldn't hire them until the contract was settled, because we couldn't hire them and then use the grant revenue. But we were able to get rid of our contract nurses with this revenue of in-house nurses, at least on paper. I am curious to know why we can't fill these positions, but the fact is we have that pot of money that we should be using for this kind of work somehow.
Legislator Bartels.
I mean, despite the caution that the Commissioner of Finance raises, which I mean it's to be taken seriously, but given that we're doing the same thing we have done the same things with contracts on nurses, I think it would be worth at least looking into the possibility of doing this as a contract, given that there may be monies down the road, depending on how this goes. I mean, it would be very frustrating to find out that there's money available 6 months in and we can't use it because we've already hired the position 6 months in advance, or any number, whatever, pick the date you want. So I just think it should be evaluated.
I just passed that question along to the deputy county executive, just for your.
Okay, so let's get a response to can it be contract. Okay, any other questions on this one? Okay, thank you very much. The next one is CASAP, and discovery position, and that's Legislator Ronk. Can I get a motion to move it?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Walter? Great. Go ahead, Ken.
So these were passed along to me by the sheriff, and I'm carrying them for him. I don't know if he's here. I had asked him to be able to be here. I don't see him on the participants list. He would be a lot more able to answer questions on this particular one than I would be. But if anybody has any questions, I can pass them along to him.
So this is it. So as I read it, this is helping to take the body cam data and help facilitate requests from the district attorney's office. Is that correct?
Yeah. So obviously with the discovery reform, Dave Clegg came and talked about some of the challenges that it's providing to his office. I think that the challenges with the discovery reform are going to be even more difficult for the police. In addition to the discovery reform, the police reforms that were passed by the state legislature, requires that this information be more readily available than it has been in the past. This would help in the distribution both to the DA and I think to the state attorney general's office. When there's a police involved incident as well.
Okay. Legislator Walter?
No, he just said what I said with this.
Okay.
Thanks.
So we're covered. Any questions, Legislator Bartels?
Did the sheriff ask for this in the budget and it just wasn't funded? Is that what happened?
Bertels. This wasn't part of a budget discussion with the sheriff.
It looks like it just got enacted in the end of October. Am I reading this correctly? This position was mandated. Is that correct?
I didn't understand that either.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah. Do you know, Ken?
I don't.
I believe they created it as part time for now. That's the order and determination via personnel. I don't believe.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Right now.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah.
So as per personnel. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll endeavor to reach out to the sheriff, but is there any way, can we try to make sure that he's here on?
I'm going to ask him to be. He told me that he was going to try that he was going to be on this afternoon, but he also told me that he had several other Zoom meetings that he had commitments for.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
All right. So we'll try and get more information on this. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. The next one you have is the fire coordinator.
Yes.
Hey, Lynn. Can I just interrupt? I believe in terms of the backup with the sheriff's department, there was a potential amendment, and I don't know where it is. If you look in the backup, it mentions three other positions, and this has to do with the grant that was approved by the legislature for $900,000.
The COSAP grant, yeah.
Yes. That amendment is not here. And I believe that's why they have on the agenda the COSAP and discovery positions, because you're missing the one amendment.
I was wondering where those positions were.
I was looking at the backup and they mentioned the positions, but that amendment is not here.
Right. And the fact that it was called COSAP was confusing me because
it's
not the discovery position. So I think it's COSAP and discovery.
Yeah, because I know they contacted.
Oh, so we have an amendment missing, Amber?
Nothing for that was submitted to me.
So COSAP wasn't submitted.
It's part of the backup, if you look, but they didn't provide the amendment for it. And I know they worked with me on the position numbers and such.
I'll reach out to the sheriff then on that as well, because it was my understanding that was going to be in this packet. So
what we're saying, though, is that the backup's in the package, but there's no amendment that's been.
I understand. That's what I'm going to
read. The entire grant is in the backup, but the amendment itself is not.
Okay. And is this one of the positions for the COSAP, or no? It's separate.
This is a completely separate position, the discovery.
So that may have been some confusion. Amber, if you could potentially take a look at it, and then we'll get the.
I didn't write these. They were submitted to me, but.
Okay.
you know, I mean, I'll follow up.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Legislator Bartels?
Thanks. Are these positions, I mean, I know we don't have them all in front of us, but are they all funded by the grant?
Yeah. Yes. It's all funded through the grant. Yep.
Okay.
And like I said, you'll see in the backup, they actually mentioned the position numbers and titles. You just weren't provided the amendment.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Right. Thank you for the clarification. All right. So the next one is the fire coordinator.
Yes. So we have talked about, you know, several times, you know, throughout the process of building the County Fire Training Center in having a, you know, part-time fire coordinator who, part-time deputy fire coordinator whose job it would be to manage the fire training center, not just scheduling, but ensuring that the training that happens there is in accordance with OFPC standards and makes sure that, you know, we're not going to cause damage to our facility. To my knowledge, in conversations with members of the firematic community, it had not been created or filled. And I think it's penny wise and pound foolish to build an $8 million county fire training center and not have someone whose job it is to make sure that it doesn't get wrecked. I can tell you that in Orange County, they have a really beautiful fire training center that is very well taken care of, and they have a full-time person who handles the fire training center and makes sure that it's that everything is proper that happens there. Everett Erickson, our fire coordinator, does a fantastic job. And the deputies that are already there, the part-time deputy fire coordinators, each handle a battalion, which is a certain number of fire departments throughout the county. When Everett came in as the fire coordinator, he switched around the battalions, so they make a great deal more sense now. But this person would have their whole part-time job would be to ensure that fire training happens properly at our fire training center.
Is that finished yet?
It is. You know? Yeah, they burned their last. They had a whole weekend worth of live burns last weekend, and a couple weeks ago they had you know. And I encourage anybody who hasn't seen it, please go see it. It's really extraordinary. We actually, our fire training center, you can has more area to burn in than the state fire training center in Montour Falls. You can burn in more rooms in this building than any other fire training center in the state.
Legislator Bartels.
A question for Legislator Ronk. How did you come up with the salary that you're proposing?
It's the same salary as the other deputy fire coordinators. It's a part-time salary.
Okay. And can I just ask another question of Legislator Ronk?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it, it's not hour dependent, the part-time salary, or is it based on a certain number of hours?
There's a certain hourly salary, but like every position in the county has a certain hourly salary, but that's like a not to exceed amount.
That was more my question. Is that a not to exceed amount? Okay.
Yeah, it wouldn't go higher than that. Like we wouldn't end up overspending that line. No.
Any other questions? Okay. All right, the next one's mine. It's Enterprise West's motion for discussion. Legislator Donaldson and Legislator Haynes, thank you. So this is just pushing out the capital plan projection of 500,000 and change from 2021 to 2022. I had put this in even before the other resolution the other night. We've already invested in bringing the building online. And, you know, we've had a lot of discussion around looking to sell the building, finding someone to do it. I just want to ensure that we push this out another year, and just to ensure that we're not going to have a resolution before us looking at additional improvements to a building that we really shouldn't hang on to without significant conversation. Legislator Ronk.
Never mind.
Anybody else? Legislator Walter.
Yeah, I would say I do feel more comfortable with this given our conversations. I mean, so during the tour, it was made clear that the resolution that was before us a few days ago was really what was necessary to be able to show the place to funders, to make it secure, to make it more attractive, to make it available for whatever the next step is. And Tim at the time acknowledged not knowing really what the next step is, where it would go, whether we're selling it, whether we're putting someone in. So I felt uncomfortable about the idea that there was already money put in to do more work in 2021, saying that even though it has to come through resolution, when it's in the capital project, it almost feels like a passive yes, and it becomes a little bit harder. I know it isn't a yes, but it feels like a passive yes. And given the fact that we don't know what the plan is yet, it did make me feel uncomfortable. You know, so far we're at, I mean, I don't know the exact amount, was it like 700,000, 800,000 as of the resolution we just passed that we're putting in there, that I would feel more comfortable kind of pausing until we knew, understood where the next steps planned, where it might be that what we're doing right now is all we have to do. And that could easily be it.
Well, and this was originally a kind of a projection out that was given. So, I didn't zero it out. I just said, let's push it out. And then if, in fact, it needs to be looked at from a capital planning perspective next year, then we have more conversation and better clarity around the disposition of the building. Yes, Legislator Criswell.
Yeah, one thing that came up when I was doing the tour was there was a conversation about contracts over 50,000. And I just wonder, is there some way that we can more tightly monitor the spending on this building and not just see contracts over 50,000? I mean, those are the ones that need to be approved, but can we better understand the contracts that are 49,999 and what that spending is about?
Yeah, so it came up in ours as well. And we did two things this past year, which help to kind of focus in on that. One, we passed a resolution that we get a monthly update around whatever is happening in Tech City. And we also put in an amendment that says any combination of invoices that bring you to the 50,000 have to be brought before us. So, you know, it just means it comes to before us sooner rather than later. So if it's under 50, but a combination of them. So I think in both of those ways, we kind of cover ourselves that we will get informed. I think we've got a good set of documents from Tim Wiedemann as to what is going to be entailed in this $399,000 that was just approved. So I think that, you know, we have the right fail safes in place, particularly going into a tough year where we'll have the conversation.
Thank you. That just raised my antenna a little on the tour, and I was like, ooh, you got to think about that.
Yeah, no, it came up in ours as well. So
thank you.
And Legislator Ronk, did I see your hand up?
Yeah, I changed my mind again.
Okay.
I'm good.
All right. Any other questions on this? Okay, let's move on. The next one is funded retirement incentive positions, and this again is mine. And I'd like somebody to move it for discussion.
I'll move it for discussion.
Great.
I'll second.
Thank you. So these are positions that were originally targeted as potential backfills. We had, and I'll give you, and there was a lot of data supplied, but if you go to one of the very last pages, it really kind of takes all the backup data and gives you an overview. We had 42 positions that are included in this amendment. And the other one that we'll be talking about, 14 positions that were identified as backfilled have already been backfilled. They left this year and they were filled. We have another 42 that were defunded in the budget. And then we have 23 that were identified as reimbursable. So those have been put to the side. And we had four department head positions that we figured those would have to be filled. So we put those aside. And what we're really focusing on here is the 42, some of the folks will be leaving in the first quarter. And it's just a way of creating, and the proposal here is to put it in contingency so that we could have more conversation when the time comes for backfilling positions. We had a number of them that were backfilled throughout this year. And I think as we go into next year, there was a commitment to have dialogue and conversation about these backfilled positions. And I think it would be helpful for us to keep it in contingency and create a process whereby we can have some conversation before these positions get filled. That was the intent of this. Legislator Ronk.
Thank you. Did you happen to have any conversations with any of the elected officials that have people in here? I received calls from the county clerk and the county sheriff about some of these positions and concerns about, what the motivation here was. I feel like a courtesy call to, some of these folks would have been, gone a long way to, ensure that to them that they're not, being targeted for elimination, because that's what this felt like to them. I can tell you that, the sheriff's department is down several positions, even from what, he had negotiated with the county executive to keep in the budget. I know that they're seeing a increase in inmates at the jail, as was talked about earlier by Michael Berg and what's his name? Doyle. I want to say Dennis, but that's not right. It's
Brian.
Brian, right.
No, and unfortunately, I did not have the time. But again, this is only to put this in contingency and create the opportunity for a dialogue before these positions get filled. It is not to take them away. It is just to say, to have that conversation. And some of these, we were originally, that was, I thought, the whole intent of the incentive and the backfill. We got the list. There are two in one of the other ones that were originally identified as not being backfilled, but they showed up in the budget as being backfilled. So it's just trying to sort through this. It's to create the conversation.
Okay, I understand. Yeah, I'm just saying that, in this resolution includes the guy who drove, the person who drives the DMV bus. Previously, it was, Jeff Berrien. Without that, it's, titled security guard, but without that position in the DMV budget, in a year without COVID, we would see hundreds of thousands of dollars in, in lost revenue from the DMV bus. Because if you've got no one to drive the bus, you can't get the bus to Shongum, Shandaken, and, Ellenville.
Are you saying it's a reimbursable position?
No.
You're just saying, listen, nobody,
just,
none of
I'm
these
just
are.
Saying, you talked about positions that wouldn't have been backfilled. That's one of the positions that definitely would have been backfilled.
Well, these are positions that would have been backfilled that are targeted for backfill. And while we're saying is we'd like a conversation around this, and maybe there's some that we have already, and you're right, I haven't spoken to the departments, but the whole intent here is to have a process going into 2021, which is a tighter process around, what jobs we're backfilling and which ones we're not.
Thanks. Just as a follow-up to that, it feels a little bit micromanaging in several of these departments to, if we were told that they were going to be targeted for backfill, I don't know why we would then be set, and nobody second-guessed it back then. I don't know why we would be second guessing the desire to backfill at this point. I would understand if this was a list of positions, I think the next one might be, that were not targeted for backfill that show up in the budget.
And that
makes a little bit that makes a great deal more sense to me
than taking these positions out of the departments that we intended to backfill them in and then saying, no, you've got to come and ask the legislature to backfill these positions now.
Well, it goes back to the conversation we were having originally, which is that we would have a conversation about what jobs would backfill. And this is the conversation. This is the budget. We were presented with it. So I think that it creates the conversation around when do these jobs get filled? How are they getting filled? And we didn't take jobs that were revenue generating and put them in. We didn't, it's not terminating any positions. All it is creating an opportunity for a conversation before some of these jobs get filled.
I'll use the example once again of the security guards position. I mean, Nina pretty much said to me that she could have backfilled it already. Mr. Berrien is out of the position now, he retired, but she hadn't because, it made more sense to her to save the county money when the bus wouldn't be running anyway, rather than backfilling it. But now her department is actually being penalized by not backfilling it previously and saving the county money, because now that's going to go into contingency and she's going to have to come back to us January, February, March and beg for it.
Begging for it. It's putting a conversation on the table to have a rational conversation about headcount in a difficult year. I don't see what's wrong with that.
What rational conversation?
Legislative Walter.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm just, again, my ignorance can you just explain to me how, like, what makes this different? Is it that if it doesn't go into contingency, these positions could be filled and we never have any input on any of them? And if it goes in contingency, we did, like, just help me, I just want to understand what changes by putting it in contingency.
Well, it just means that the jobs won't be filled and the money will sit there until it's needed and then it gets drawn down.
Sorry, but what happens if it doesn't? Like if it stays as it is? I don't know. Does that mean that they could just fill it without ever running it by us?
Or use it for other purposes? Yeah. Chairman Donaldson?
Well, I don't see them using it for other purposes. I agree with Ken on this one because you're talking about elected officials that, and we all agreed that these positions were going to have to be backfilled. So I believe they need the flexibility to backfill them when they need to backfill them. That's the whole purpose of it. I don't think, and I realize, maybe Ken overstated by saying they have to come and beg, but they do have to come and ask. Wait, we'll discuss it. It'll be postponed a couple of times, and then finally they get the money, and it's like two months before they get to fill this position that they want to fill. And I think they were the ones that ran for these offices, and they explained what they needed, and we agreed with that. And now, well, we agree with you, but not really. We were only kidding. The point is, you have to allow them to do their job. And like he was pointing out, I know for, like the bus, that is a revenue generator when they're actually running around doing these things. But Nina realized that she can save money by not having it out because they're not going to be doing it. So they didn't send it out, didn't backfill the position, and now, soon after a couple of months from now, when she wants to backfill it, she's going to want to backfill it, and I think she should be able to backfill it. That's what she was elected to do, to run the county clerk's office. And the same thing goes with the sheriff. We already agreed that these positions were to be filled when he needed them. So why are we making him jump through another hoop? I don't get it.
So we're in, if I may, Legislator Ronk, I want to respond to Chairman Donaldson's comment.
Of course.
First of all, we never agreed. All we received was a list of what jobs took the incentive, which ones were going to be backfilled. And we got more information as the time went on, but we never had a conversation. The conversation is now in the budget cycle. And all I'm saying is that you know, we have a number of positions that we haven't filled. That's correct. We're going into a very difficult year. And all we're saying is, let's have a little bit more of a conversation about what jobs we're filling versus finding out about some of them after the fact. If we approve the budget as is, we're basically saying, go ahead and fill them. And we've had really no conversation about this. That's all I'm saying. Legislative Runk?
Yeah, thank you. And whereas Legislator Donaldson's right, I did overstate with Beg. That was, you know, for dramatic effect, I think, a little bit, as we all do from time to time. But I think that, you know, whereas I overstated that, I believe that you understated, Chairwoman, to Legislator Walter's question about what happens if we put it in contingency. And what happens if we put it in contingency is we're going to have how many positions are here, Legislator Archer? 40-something?
42, yeah, 42.
So we're going to have, you know, if we end up filling these positions, 42 individual resolutions to fill a position in the sheriff's office, a position in the, you know, in the clerk's office, a position in the jail. Whereas if we budgeted, you know, normally for these positions, we would have, you know, all of the positions would be in the budget. And if they went out to hire for the position, found somebody, they would be able to fill the position. They do an RTF with the county executive's office, finance and personnel, and fill the position. The county executive would sign off or not on the RTF. The county executive, I believe, the county executive's office was not signing off on a lot of RTFs this year, particularly from the sheriff's office. And I think that, you know, the positions in here that are to be filled is a, you know, is a compromise with the sheriff and the executive's office on how many positions that are open that, you know, we were going to budget for. You know, I don't disagree that this is the time to have the conversation. I just don't think that this is the mechanism to do it, Legislator Archer. I think
so what mechanism would you suggest? Because
well, if you'd like to not cut me off, which you wouldn't let other people do to another member of the committee, Legislator Archer, I was in the middle of explaining that. I was actually in the middle of a breath at that point. But
that's I'm just asking.
I was about to tell you before you asked.
Okay.
Again, dramatic effect overstating a little bit, perhaps. But, you know, I believe that the way to have this conversation is to bring these department heads in and discuss them and discuss whether we want them in the budget or not. I don't think that the time to discuss these things is in January, February, and March when these positions would likely be filled. They're currently budgeted for this year. We could fill them in December, and then what happens to the budget in January? They get fired. I don't necessarily agree that this is the right mechanism to handle a discussion about which of these positions are, you know, should be hired and shouldn't be hired.
So given our time constraints and given all of that we've been trying to accomplish, when do you propose to do something like this? Do you want to do it on Tuesday? I'm happy to do it on Tuesday. Let's bring them in and have a conversation about this.
Well, as of right now, Legislator Archer, all of these department heads who are not made aware of this, except by the amendments coming out, think that these positions are being removed from their offices.
They're not being removed.
I'm aware that you're saying they're not being removed, but I'm saying that the conversation with them never even happened, so they think they're being removed.
Legislative Walter?
Yeah, I have a follow-up question to my question. So does in any way doing the contingency also potentially protect them? And I guess the reason why I ask is I was told by several different department heads that positions that were approved in the 2020 budget, the executive office never allowed them to hire. And there was a lot of frustration coming from some of the same people, same departments that are listed there, that they were promised these positions and they never got them. So I'm just curious, and again, I don't know the answer, that's why I'm asking truly, because I don't understand it, but would putting them in this, doing it that way, protect them more where maybe the sheriff could then put it in directly to us?
No.
Legislator, no. Chair Donaldson?
No, that wouldn't protect them at all. In a sense, it is eliminating the position because you're putting it in contingency. So the position, in a sense, is being eliminated and they have to come back and ask for it. So, I mean, and I understand doing that in certain instances, and I agree with it. I don't agree with it here. I think because these positions were positions that they feel that were needed. They needed them. And the county executive put it in the budget because he understood that they needed them. But having said that, they did that last year, and then yes, it's true. They did not fill certain positions. And even though they had them in their budget, the county executive decided he wasn't going to fill them because he was trying to save the money. So he was doing everything he could to save that those dollars. Now, if he felt that they didn't need to be filled, he would not have put them in the budget for this year. But these were ones that they agreed that they needed to be filled. So, I mean, we could have the discussion now. We could, keep on having the discussion. My mindset is I just don't agree with it at this point. I think we could have that discussion in after the budget. We can still have the discussion. And let's talk about those positions if you want to talk about them. If they're not filled yet, you could certainly talk about them. But, I just think this makes it like the positions are not there because I'm taking money, putting in a contingency. So that means the positions aren't there, technically.
Legislator Bartels.
Yeah. Well, I respectfully disagree with the fact that it's cutting the positions. Cutting the positions would be zeroing the lines and removing the money and putting the money in contingency. The money's moved in contingency, but the line remains, which means in order to fund the line, as Legislator Ronk said, there would have to be a request for a resolution to move the money from contingency into the line that exists in the budget. So, and it's clear that this is an intent. The intent is to have the conversation. I think the idea of having the conversation in January or February or once the budget's passed, it's an academic conversation for the legislature pretty much at that point. So, you know, I don't know Legislator Ronk's earlier suggestion about having department heads in. Again, we're under extreme time constraints, so I don't know how we do that. But I don't know if you're being serious about that recommendation, but that having the conversation, the time to have it would be now.
Chairman Donaldson.
I think he was pointing out the conversation should have been had before this resolution gets put in, or before this amendment gets put in. And you're zeroing out the position. You're leaving the line there, but it's zeroed out and put into contingency. It's taken out of there. And I think it's a micromanaging. And you know what? I want questions asked and answered. I want to be thorough. But I don't want to micromanage each one of these departments. That's what we're not here for that.
Chair, Legislator Ronk.
Thank you. I tend to sort of agree with what Legislator Donaldson said in that I believe that, if I were going to put in a resolution like this, I would have had a conversation with, with the at least the elected officials beforehand. If not, with the county executive himself or the deputy county executives about the individual positions, especially since, as Legislator Donaldson said, some of these positions might not be considered revenue generating because there's no state revenue attached to them or anything of that nature. But the DMV bus position is absolutely positively a revenue generating position. It generates well more than what we put into it, and provides a vital service to especially outlying areas of the county. I was not being facetious, Legislator Bartels, in that I think that the time to have a conversation is before the budget's passed, and if that means that I have to sit through another 4-hour meeting on Tuesday, I will. If it's possible that we come to some sort of a landing on it. But going back to what Legislator Donaldson said, it's not as easy as in January we say, okay, you can hire this position, because it's going to, that's where the micromanaging comes in. The micromanaging isn't putting it into contingency. The micromanaging comes, well, do you really need this position? Could we reclassify it as this position? Could we do this? And then we become sort of, 23 county executives or 23 county sheriffs or 23 county clerks. That's where things like this devolve. I've seen the legislature try to grab back into operations many times since I've been a legislator. I operated 1 year under the old form, and then it'll be 13 under the new form after next year. I do not want to see us go back down that rabbit hole. I think that the county executive form of government is really important because it provides the kind of operational flexibility that we didn't used to have when, we had, 33 at that point, county executives with one leading the legislature. When you try to do things by committee, you end up, deciding what color the walls are, after 4 months of debate and discussion and 3 engineering reports. I have very deep concern about the precedent we set by, individually as legislators turning ourselves into department heads, county executives, county sheriffs, county clerks by deciding what positions they should or shouldn't fill, when they should or shouldn't fill them, when they're approved in a budget.
So this is our only mechanism for discussion and funding of what was initiative to save us money. This was the retirement incentive. We got a list. There was commitment from the get-go that we'd be able to sit down. We're in the middle of a budget cycle with a very compressed time frame. All this does is give us the opportunity to set those aside so that the conversation can be had. Once it's approved, there's no obligation for any conversation. It is what it is. So as appropriators, as our responsibility as legislators, I think this is just is meant to be an opportunity to leverage. We know 15 of those jobs or 14 of those jobs had already been filled without a conversation, but there was always a commitment to have the conversation. And I don't see the harm in being able to put it aside as we're in an extremely crunch period and having a conversation. I feel like, there's some over dramatization as to, oh my God, this is, they're going to have to jump through hoops. It's a conversation. And this is the only way we can get questions answered to be able to do that. Otherwise, we're approving it after the fact. There's no, what's the use of a conversation after the fact? If they've already got the approvals, all we're trying to say is we can't have a dialogue about this in a very compressed period of time. Chairman Donaldson.
Well, I think when we're dealing with this, the conversation should have been had when they put out all the information saying that these positions were going to be refilled. And at that point there, then you should have said why. That should have been the conversation then. It should have been picked apart in every which way you could and doing it then. I don't think an amendment in the last minute here for the budget, without conversations even with the elected officials, is appropriate. I think it's micromanaging. Ken was pointing out, it's the same thing. When we start micromanaging, when they're doing a building and things of that nature, you don't build a house through a committee. I would hate to see what the hell it was going to look like. And I've been there, as Ken pointed out. I've been many years under the old system with the committee system. And let's face reality, that's what brought us the jail in the end. Brought us those increases, brought us the increases like throwing in, we'll just throw in extra taxes. That'll be fine. You have to have somebody at the helm, and these are department heads. The elected officials should have been brought in on this. And it is cutting the funding to the position. It's going in the contingency account. That means they really can't guarantee that it's there because they're going to have to, and they are jumping through hoops. Let's face reality.
But isn't that what the whole budget is?
I don't know if you've attended these same meetings or not, but they jump through hoops now. And I'm fine. I'm fine with making them jump through hoops at times. But the point is, these were ones that they said they needed to backfill, and it was an agreement, and we agreed with it without question. So you had the question at that. You had to say, wait a minute, Why are these being that? Why is this one? Let's look at this one. Let's look at that one.
Chairman, when have we had time? When have we had time? And seriously, no disrespect intended. What's our job then? What is the role of a legislator then? Seriously.
It's to oversee these things without micromanaging.
So oversee with no questions.
How is there no questions here?
Well, but part of that is a compressed time frame for a part-time legislator given all of this versus and waiting for questions to get answered. I'm sorry. I'm really struggling to understand then how you see us getting our job done as part-time legislators with all of us having our own full-time jobs in addition to trying to manage a budget cycle compressed where we don't have sufficient time to look everything.
That's why we hire full-time people.
Explain to me how you would expect to do this.
That's why we hire full-time people. That's why we have an elected county executive. That's why we have an elected county clerk, an elected sheriff. That's why we have those people. I'm not the sheriff. You're not the sheriff.
I never said I was. Legislator Ronk.
Thank you. Well, by my count, and it was a quick count, 13 of those positions are in the sheriff's office, either in corrections or criminal. The sheriff has been kind enough to join us. Perhaps we could have some of the dialogue now about 13 of them. I mean, it's like a more than a quarter of the positions. I mean, perhaps not. Maybe that's not what the committee would like, but I'm just throwing that out there as a possibility since we don't have much time.
Yeah, I would like to hear from the sheriff on that then. I agree with you. He's here. Let's get an opinion from him.
Legislator Bartels.
I don't want to cause a disruption, but while the sheriff's here, can we also hear about the grants that he intended to come?
COSAP,
yes. Those positions, the COSAP.
COSAP and Discovery.
COSAP and Discovery. Yeah, we could do it in whatever order, but I'd like to hear about that as well.
Just before he does, can I just, Amber did send us that, so I don't know if we want to add it to the agenda officially, the COSAP.
Well, it is already in the agenda.
Okay, so we do have, just so you know, if you haven't seen it, it's in everyone's email, that information.
Sheriff, welcome. If you could share with us the COSAP and the Discovery and the rationale for that, that would be great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the legislature. As you know, we got a $900,000 grant, the BGA grant, and the grant was written in conjunction with the Department of Health and the Sheriff's Office. The positions for the first time will embed a social worker, two peer advocates, and a part-time administrative assistant to a law enforcement entity. And this in itself is a culture change for law enforcement and how we do business. The importance of hiring these individuals is not only for the sheriff's office and to deal as a high mitigation risk team in the city of Kingston, where 40% of our overdoses are occurring, but to have these individuals available to every single law enforcement entity in the county as we build up Oracle, the mitigation team, and the referrals. These individuals will be able to tailor a plan not only to those that need to go to rehab, but to the family members that are suffering from the stigma associated with this epidemic. And it's more of an epidemic now than it has been in the past due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So I ask and implore that these individuals, that you folks grant the permission to hire these individuals for this grant.
Any questions? Legislator Walter?
No, just to add on that, if you can also give information about the Discovery position, and I'm sorry to keep adding more things, but since you're here, there was a conversation about an upgrade on Black Creek versus a full rehab, and if if there's anything you want to add to that too. Mm-hmm. I know that your list is getting longer and longer, but that was.
Yes, ma'am. I will talk about the discovery position first. So the discovery position was in response to the new discovery law that was passed by the state legislature this past year. That individual is responsible for collecting all the body cam information, all the 911 calls, every single report that's associated with a particular case, not just for the sheriff's office, but also for a lot of the smaller police departments as well, that use the law enforcement records management system that's controlled by the sheriff's office. And it's a huge job. And because of the time frame that this information has to be submitted to DEMS, which is the digital management system that the state put together for both defense attorneys and the district attorney's office. So when they go to court, that everything is up, front, downloaded, prepared, so they can move forward in their court proceedings. The timeliness of this information to get out is extremely important. And to have someone to do that is extremely important, especially in light of what's going on with our criminal justice system. So that's the importance of that discovery coordinator. In reference to Black Creek, for the last couple of years, Black Creek, we had submitted capital project requests for Black Creek. The system was put in place in 2007 and has not been upgraded since 2011. I've sent some information to the legislature in regards to every weekend, every other day, the system is constantly breaking down. This is the entire security system for the jail and this facility. That's all the video cameras. That's all the doors and locks, the entire security system within the Ulster County Law Enforcement Center.
Sorry, Juan, I don't want to interrupt you, but the question specifically, because we gave all that background,
okay.
Is the difference between doing the 600,000 upgrade versus how you feel if the decision was that it made more sense bonding a $2 million rehab. So just your thoughts about it. That being a preferred or definitely not preferred path. That's all. Yeah.
So, and I do understand the issues of the COVID-19 and the budget situation that the county's facing. But at some point, either we're going to pay now, or we're going to pay more later. So this system now, we're spending about almost $50,000 of maintenance per year. If the upgrade is done, that number is going to be reduced to about $20,000 a year. And so in the long term, if we fix it and get it up and overhauled the way it's supposed to, we'll be saving taxpayers money at the end. Obviously, due to the situation that we're in, I obviously, if I could get it upgraded now, it'd be great for the long term. But I also realize because of COVID-19 that the issues we have, the upgrade of the system, though, is important. And at some point, it has to be done. Because the longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to be to get it upgraded.
Sorry, do you oppose the idea of a new system?
I do not.
Okay,
I do not.
That's
oppose.
All I wanted to know. Thank you.
I just have a quick question.
Senator Haynes, go ahead.
What would happen if the officer in charge of fixing the upgrades were no longer with you?
So. The CO, Chris Howe, is presently training folks to take over his job. He is one of the folks that is going to retire. And it's a tremendous loss. He is the one that fixes everything. I mean, some of our systems are digital, and we're using, I guess, like a monologue system. He knows how to fix all that. But once he goes, we're going to lose that expertise. He is training someone now, but you're right, legislator. It's going to be an uphill battle to replace somebody like a Chris Howe.
Legislator Bartels.
Excuse my ignorance, but is he leaving shortly?
I believe it's in March.
that shortly. Okay. Undertaking this upgrade, you know, on the fate, if the annual cost of around $57,000 were to remain level, undertaking this upgrade would actually cost the taxpayers more money than paying $57,000 a year, because while it would cut that cost in half, we'd incur the cost of $600,000+. So what I'm trying to understand is what, beyond the financial figure, what would this upgrade do that just going along for the next 5 years at the $57,000 would not do?
A lot of these systems that we have here now are getting really close to end of life. These parts are irreplaceable. They don't make them anymore. The programs need to be upgraded. So at some point, these systems are going to shut down because they're not going to be supported. And so that's the issue that we're looking at when we're looking at the future and the cost of a Black Creek upgrade.
And if I could just follow on, so that the upgrade would address those, don't let me put words in your mouth, but the imminent end of life issues for some of the systems. Just the upgrade, not the full replacement, the upgrade would address that as well?
That's correct. The upgrade would adjust it, would help us toward fixing some of its end of life issues.
Thank you, Chair.
Legislator Haynes?
I just have one last question. And then also, the longer we wait, the more expensive the program gets. Am I correct in thinking that? The cost increases for a full replacement program?
Correct.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yeah, sure. What would the upgrade actually do? What would it be, changing certain locks to newer ones? I mean, to where you'll actually be able to get the parts? Or are you just, the upgrade would be getting all the necessary parts? And unfortunately, by getting all those necessary parts, the upgrade is only going to be lasting, you know, so long, as opposed to a new system.
So I'm seeing if Mr. Howe is here so I can have him explain it better. If you're talking about computer upgrades for the most part, it's the program itself. And again, you have monologue systems that we are still using. It's like having a computer that's 15, 20 years old. It's obsolete, and the system becomes obsolete. And the longer it goes, the more expensive it's going to be to update and change.
Thanks. I just want to remind the committee that, you know, and to the sheriff as well, that, you know, this is just to put it in the capital plan. We would then also need to create a capital project in the, you know, by resolution and fund it by resolution. So there's plenty of time, you know, hopefully before March, for Howie to explain it to us and, you know, yeah, and for us to learn more about it.
Chairman Donaldson?
Are we finished with this particular issue? Can we go to the other one?
Go to the issue of the staffing. So, Sheriff, we have a resolution that I've put in, which basically looks at the individuals who were part of the retirement incentive and which of those positions are being considered for backfilling. We have not had a chance to have a conversation about that. This was meant as a placeholder in the budget to be able to have conversations. Most of the folks that I think of the seven folks in your area, or sorry, seven, eight, nine folks in your area that took the incentive, only two are not being backfilled. The other seven are, and some of them have already been replaced. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So the whole point of putting this in was we've never had a chance to talk about the backfilling of the positions based on the incentive, which was meant to hopefully reduce staff through attrition, and as well as look at which ones did we actually have to fill and how do we do that in the most cost-effective way? So we hope to have some savings on more junior-level people coming in. So most of the folks that I see on your list are scheduled to be here through March, with maybe one exception, or further on into the year. So we thought we would have a conversation. I now realize that people are thinking it's being cut, and the only intent here was to take the positions, put them in contingency till we had the opportunity to have a conversation. And then, you know, as needed, I assume that, you know, of the nine that you had exit, you're feeling strongly that you need to backfill seven of these, correct?
Yes, ma'am. We made an agreement with the county executive. Mm-hmm. Remember, the staffing levels are the job of the State Commission on Corrections. With that said, though, we were able to close some of the it's a complicated process to actually go to the State Commission on Corrections and shut down a pod, because then it takes a year or two to get them back down to open it again. So these staffing levels, we agreed with the county exec to go from 157 to 147 on that, with 10 of those positions not being redlined, but not being funded, which means I would go in front of the legislature if I needed them next year and request for them with a justification. So the other positions that we're talking about, the retirement incentives, incentive one, unless they were part of those 10, and I don't believe that they are, will affect that deal, and the staffing levels that are required by the State Commission on Corrections. As far as the criminal division side of the house, the people that have retired where you're or going to retire, where you're higher end people that aren't making the same amount of money as a new join, and these are not additional positions that we're talking about. These are positions that are already in place and in existence within the budget. Then the importance of these positions when it comes to public safety are extremely important, especially now with a pandemic going on and our numbers going through the roof with not only crime, but the opioid epidemic. And to put public safety at risk, sometimes it costs money to keep people safe, and sometimes these things have to be looked at. You know, crime, there is no price on crime, and nor is crime predictable. And so to remove these positions at this time is just not a good idea. And they're in there for a particular reason, and that is to do the job that we need to do here at the sheriff's office to keep the peace and have the county safe, public safety. Everything from burglaries on the uptick, larcenies, domestics, vehicle accidents, and like I said earlier, overdoses and drug cases are also on the uptick, especially now that we're going into phase two.
So, Sheriff, this was never to remove these positions, and in fact, most of them are currently filled and will be through, in some cases, February, March, July of next year. This is only meant for a conversation with regards to replacing them. So nobody's ever trying to remove them and say they should not be a part. It was just meant to have a conversation, which unfortunately timing is everything. Not able to have that conversation before we were looking at the budget and really comprehending all the aspects of it. And how many of the 125 who elected for the incentive, how many of them we were bringing back in a year that we know is going to be challenging for all departments. So just so we're clear, there was never an intent to leave a gap in the safety of the people of the community or your department.
Well, thank you, Chair. I also want to add that the folks that we have been hiring, usually when it comes to folks that have to be let go, if that was the case, and I know that's not the case, would be the minorities that were hired to diversify this office and make the culture change that's needed. So I really appreciate your statement. Thank you.
Yeah, just for clarity's sake, and are you overlapping hiring of these people during this? So if you've got someone targeting to leave, obviously you're going to start recruiting at some point, right?
We can't really replace them until they leave.
Right. So, but are you recruiting now, or are you
waiting? Yes, we are.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Chairman Donaldson?
Or are you telling me you don't mind us putting them in contingency?
Excuse me, Chairman?
I said what happens is this amendment is to take all those positions and zero them out,
no,
leave
sir.
The line no. there, but put them into contingency.
No, sir. We could not afford to put anyone.
Oh, no. You can come to us and ask for them. I mean, this is what this does, this amendment. It puts the positions in contingency. It puts the money in contingency. And if you want that money, if you want that position, you need to come to the legislature to ask for it. Is that what you think is a good way of dealing with this?
No, Chairman. That would impede the operation of this office. The deal that I made with the county executive in regard to the corrections side of it was based on the low numbers at the county jail, which at the time were about 115.
Yeah, but this is on the sheriff's side. Sorry, Sheriff. This is not on the corrections side.
There are corrections officers in here, Legislator Archer.
That's right. There's corrections officers.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. There are.
Would impede on the operation of my office, and I would prefer that you would not do that.
Can I ask a point of clarification?
Yes, please.
And this is to Amber and Natalie and perhaps Bert, but he left. He'll be back, I'm sure. What I don't understand is if there are individuals in these positions already, we're taking the position out of the department and putting it into contingency. I'm very confused as to what happens to that person's employment. Contingency isn't an office in the county. So I'm very confused now. I'm more confused now than I was previously.
It is confusing. I get it. Amber, you want to?
The amendment includes funding through the retirement date.
Okay. So the part that would be moved to contingency would be after their retirement date.
Correct.
Exactly.
That makes a modicum more sense now.
And the hope was, given the fact that there was most of them are February, March, that there would be the opportunity to have that conversation, which we don't have in a compressed time frame during a budget cycle.
I still believe it to be micromanaging, and I don't support it.
I just, if I could add, that it takes up to 6 months to hire somebody, just so everyone understands. There's a background, there's a test, there's an agility, and then once we do hire them, they go through a field training officer, portion of it before they actually get to be certified police officers. To take that out of the office of sheriff and put it in another location, it would be damaging to the operation of this office.
Yeah, I don't think that is the intent. So for clarity's sake, you just said to me that you basically, there's a long line of getting folks ready to come in. You can't bring them in prior to or even start their training until after the other person leaves, which the point being that it would give us that time between a very consolidated budget cycle to have that conversation and better understand this moving forward.
Chairman, I think I believe I was elected to do that here at the sheriff's office. That's my job. And I think those are my responsibilities to do.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was just a matter of a conversation. So, Legislator Ron.
Thanks. With that, Sheriff, if this ends up moving to contingency, it's probably like eight months because this could very well add 2 months to the process. Because of the timing of our legislative meetings as well as potential for postponement.
That would definitely not work for this office.
Legislator Walter.
Sorry, I keep asking questions on this because I'm just so. Is it just back to Legislator Ron's point? Does that mean if it was in contingency, a resolution couldn't even go in until those positions were gone? Is that what that, or is that what your point? Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Legislator Bartelf.
Sorry, again, it's a question of clarification. Why
why would you have to wait till the positions were empty until you funded the positions? I mean, you could, and in January, you could move the funding back into the line for post-retirement date without a person in it.
Our system, we have to do what's called a request to fill, and it goes through the county. And it can only be submitted once the individual has been retired.
I mean, perhaps.
No. I'm talking about our internal process. I mean, we could move the positions out of contingency at any time. We could move them out in January before people retire.
Vicky, shaking your head, yes.
Yeah, we could do that. In the same way that we would, there's a suggestion to move into contingency now, we could do that at any point. We don't have to wait for the retirement.
I'm sorry.
In reality, that would never happen in January. Sure, just so you know.
Legislative Mayo.
Thank you. Sorry, I've been in and out, but I've been trying to keep track. I understand everything that everybody's trying to do. I think everybody has the right interests, but I'm with Legislator Ronk at this time that this is not something that I would look to approve. I get we have restricted time frames, everybody does, but something like this, I think needed to be presented to the department heads and maybe ask them to present one person that if they couldn't fill, if they had to not fill a position, and those one person here, one person there, one person there, get put into something like this, so then we could have a discussion. But to just do this overall, I get the thought behind it, and I understand it because we've had the 11th hour of a lot of things happening, and now we have a pandemic we've never been before. But this is hard for me to support. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, let's move on. The next one, and these are the two positions that were on the list as not being filled, as not being backfilled. So we're pulling those off, but if there's an error here, then can you get back to us, Bert?
Lynn, if you don't mind, I just want to explain why they are in the budget. I know they were on the list originally. Remember, that list was due September 15th. These were kind of last-minute discussions back and forth. You have to remember in mental health, and these are mental health positions, if these positions are removed, we'd have to increase professional services to provide the service. So
again, are these reimbursable? Are these both being reimbursable?
They are not, but it was one of those where we'd then have to would put it in a contract to provide those services.
So did we get an updated list on changes? No, they were not, right?
No, just what you had asked for on September 15th was the intent at the time. That was the intent, but this was the last. These were changes in the last minute in the budget. That's why they are in the budget.
Okay.
And not in professional services.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'll move it for discussion.
Oh, sorry. I'll second it. Do we have a description of what these positions would do? I don't see any backup. So is it possible just to understand what these positions are and the reason why you didn't think you needed them and then you felt you did?
Yeah, I mean, they are civil service, so I can get the job specs from personnel on those. That's not
and
a problem.
And the second part also, like why you didn't think you needed them and now why you do, so we can understand the need.
It was discussions with the health, with mental health, and it ultimately they decided to keep the position rather than go through professional services.
That's all it is. So it's not a change in need. It's just on whether to do it in-house or not. Oh, okay.
Correct. Yeah.
And is it less expensive to do it in-house, even when you add in all benefits and everything?
I think one of the discussions was the professional service contract. They may not have been able to do that work. And I think ultimately that was the decision.
Could you just confirm that for us and get back to us? That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And then the final one is Chairman Donaldson's.
I'll move it for discussion.
Is there a second? Okay. Legislator Walter.
Sorry about that. Yes, if this was originally supposed to be a position and insurance that was going to be an accountant, and then the position got changed after the person was hired and was changed to a confidential secretary. So I believe that the position is not needed.
Legislator Ronk.
Yeah, just for everyone's, edification, especially those who weren't here last year through this process. This was brought to us because we were told that they needed a accountant or a fiscal person in the insurance department. And sometime in the intervening time, the executive's office, and I'm not even sure how legal the process was, reclassified it from CSCA to management non-union and created a confidential secretary in the insurance department.
Legislator Bartels.
Thank you. And just for some backstory on it as well, but I guess we could get some more information prior to the next meeting. The insurance department reports to laws and rules, and in their presentation on their budget, it was said that the person in that position, in that accounting position, had been in the position for, I want to say, 23 years. That's the number that's sticking in my head, but don't hold me to that. And it was told to us that that person was doing accounting work. And now the department had said she's taken on much of the accounting work. The confidential secretary has been partially trained to do some of the entry work. But I think that there was an accountant in that position for a very long time. That was my understanding from the budget presentation.
And I think it left a gap in the department as far as who was picking up some of the responsibilities for the auditing of the claims. Legislator Bartels.
Can I just ask for a clarification? Is this to leave that department just one person less?
Yes.
That would definitely give me pause after hearing the budget presentation, but we can get follow-up before next week if you want.
Legislator Ronk, then Walter.
Thanks. I'd be more comfortable reclassifying it back to a CSEA accounting position, personally.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
Legislator Walter.
No, I'm sorry. I was looking at the back of it and got confused about the amendment that I was looking at, but I understand now.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I think we've got everything.
I have a question about just a quick request from Legislator Ronk, if that's okay.
Sure.
Is it possible also for the COVID positions, and you're asking questions anyway, I assumed in 93 was because that's what the person was already making, but sort of some background on how much salary this type of position should be, as opposed to, we have this issue of people being moved different ways and carrying their salaries rather than being paid the salary that goes with that position. So just any kind of background on getting that value.
Will do. And I believe that on Tuesday, Deputy Executive Ryder is going to come and talk about vaccine distribution as well, because his comment to me when I went and talked to him was that the health department would be surprised to know that they don't have any role in the distribution of the vaccine. So
said they did just in several months, but yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Any other? Okay. So I think we're finished with the amendments. We have a meeting at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, the 24th, to disposition all of them. So if you've got any questions, let's try and get them answered between now and then. We've got a list of follow-ups that we'll try and get out to everybody. If anything comes to mind as you're looking through everything, please don't hesitate to reach out. And if we can get the information you need, we'll get it. Anybody have anything else?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor? Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it.